now.
Sisters, working class heroes, this is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here. Tonight on the big program, we're going to be talking about guns, guns, guns. President Obama laid out his plan on guns. Not much for me to get excited about. A lot of people were saying there are going to be tons of executive orders. He's overstepping his bounds. Not much of that, but it's not going to stop the NRA from raising money off of it. It's not going to stop the NRA from whipping people into a frenzy, getting them all wadded up in the panties. Why? Money. This is an excellent opportunity to recruit the low-information voter, to recruit the, hey, not going to take my gun. Easy way to get money out of them. And, hey, don't forget the gun manufacturers. Sales way up. And, hey, maybe good for the economy. Also going to talk about the 2016 presidential election, which is being rigged as we speak in state houses across the country. Right here in Pennsylvania, House Bill 94 was introduced, working its way through the General Assembly. We're going to talk about how they plan to steal the 2016 election. Thanks, GOP. Also, in case you didn't notice, the Republicans want you to know your taxes are going up. And, you know, I go back and I think about how many people are going to notice. Because if you remember, 45% of the people didn't realize that their taxes went down. Under President Obama when polled a year after the fact. And it was mostly in part because of the payroll tax holiday that he had enacted. And so it should be interesting to see where this goes. Personally, I was never a huge fan of that. I would have liked to have seen the rate lowered instead of taking the payroll tax away. But I understand it was the quickest way to get money in people's pocket. It was the fastest way to infuse money into the economy. Unlike during the Bush years when they were handing out prizes. How many people remember what they did with their Bush prize? You remember the $300 that you got in one check and I think it was $500 that most people got in another. And I remember the one where they actually sent a letter out to me saying, hey, check your mailbox. Your George W. prize, it's in the mail. So keep an eye out for it. And you go back to that and you go, well, politically, Bush's idea was the best because it got people to go, oh, yeah, I'm getting money back. For the economy, the Obama idea was the best, not such good politics, though, because when 45% of the people didn't realize they got it, not good politics. Good policy, not very good politics. Also going to talk about the voter suppression law that the Republicans rammed through last year. Remember that? Remember the whole push for voter suppression? Interesting story out of the western part of the state. Evidently, somebody registered to vote as Barack H. Obama. So we're going to talk a little bit about that. Also, later in the show, no nerds, no birds. Contract negotiations between the engineers and Boeing Corporation. Long-time contract negotiation. We're going to find out where this takes us. Also going to take your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. You can also email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. So for the last couple days, been very unhappy about our governor's choice. First and foremost, it's the way he went about it. It's the backdoor, thief in the night kind of way that he went about selling off our lottery system. And I look at this and I go, look, there are things that private for-profit corporations should be doing. They should be making consumer goods, tennis shoes, you know, tennis rackets, cars, whatever. I don't know that I want them doing things that have a major impact societally. And the lottery is one of those. And I got a couple of emails from folks that kind of got me thinking. I mean, Rob asked if there's anything that government does that I feel that should be privatized. And at this point, the answer is no, because all of the privatization schemes that I've seen, all of this deregulation that I've seen, has not benefited you or me working people. Benefited a handful at the top. Benefited the investor class at the very top. Not me with my 401k or none of that. The people who sit in the corner glass office, those are up at the top of the building, those are the people who are doing fine. And will always do fine in this. So, you know, in looking at all of the privatization schemes, I haven't found one. And for almost 8 years now on the air, I've been asking people, well, share it with me. If there's something that we used to do, that we have privatized, and it's actually working better for you and me, let me know. And it hasn't happened. Not yet, anyway. Got another email from Bill who asked, you know, what's the problem with privatizing the lottery and the wine and spirit shops? And the wine and spirit shops, first and foremost, to me is, I look at it as, look, this is an enterprise that I'm a shareholder in. And I'm not going to sell off my share of this for a losing proposition. I grew up in Cleveland. I've said this before, where, you know, alcohol, you go to the gas station, it's right there. It's an impulse buy. I don't want alcohol for my kids as an impulse item right there on the shelf next to the Tic Tacs. Not good public policy. Now, I mean, if you're solely looking at it as it's a consumer good and we should have access to it wherever, then that's a whole different argument. But from a societal standpoint, I worry about the major impact that having this kind of access is going to cause. The number of deaths on the highway, the number of instances of teen drinking, a whole bunch of things, spousal abuse, down the list, all of the negative societal things. And then you throw the economics on top of it, the 5,000 jobs that will disappear. Because alcohol will not be, there won't be wine and spirit shops. It'll just be something that's on a shelf in a pre-existing store. There'll be no new job. There'll be no jobs. What we'll do is we'll lose those. And it just becomes an item on a shelf with a profit margin. A profit margin that you and I, well, we benefited from. The second we sell that off, we lose that. And the other part of it is that 1% tax that we get from the wine and spirit shops that we would no longer get because of how our tax code is with businesses like Walmart paying their taxes on top. So, I mean, there's a lot to that, but that's one of my problems. One of my problems with the lottery is there's a lot of wiggle room in here. There's a lot of opportunity for things to go missing. And I was reading an article with the New York Times today, and they were talking about BP. At one point during the Thatcher years, you go back to the 80s, BP was a wholly owned entity of the British government. It was British Petroleum. It was it was their company. During the Thatcher years, they privatized it. And, you know, it has been with the success of privatization until it wasn't. It has been a very bumpy road. Early on, it struggled because it wasn't making a profit, but it was providing cheap energy, it was providing jobs, and it wasn't blowing things up. And you start looking the last couple of years. You go back to 2005 when they had a refinery in Texas that blew up, killed 15 people, injured 170. 2006, you had in Putoh Bay, Alaska, you had the pipeline spilled, hundreds of thousands of gallons into the bay. 2010, of course, you had the Deepwater Horizon, killed 11 people. Biggest offshore spill in history here in the U.S. And so you look at this, which is better? And, you know, you look at it, the article goes into the two reasons. When the government controlled it, when it was in the hands of the British government, they didn't pay attention to the profitability as much. Because they had elected officials that, you know, wanted cheap energy, and they wanted full employment. Then they went to the other extreme, which is put it in the private hands, and we're going to squeeze the quarter until the eagle screams. We're going to squeeze every bit of cost-cutting out of every single dollar, and what do you end up with? Well, you end up with slashing jobs. You end up with slashing safety, so you have all of these accidents, and huge bonuses for the very top. So I then ask, I go, because these are the two worldviews. Which one benefits you and me? Which one benefits society the best? One. Now, look, I have a problem with not being as diligent in looking for to make sure that the dollars are well spent and profitability is there. But I'm more concerned about A, full employment, and B, safety. Those, to me, are very important. So when you go and you look at this whole privatization, all the stuff that they want to privatize, what is it really about? It's about two things. It's about profit for the very top, and it's about squeezing every last ounce of efficiency, of productivity, and of profit out of something, which means that people end up working longer and harder for less. It's that simple. And I look at the lottery, and I see the exact same thing. What happens to the 170 people who are now doing what even the company and the state and everybody else says is one of the best jobs in the country of running this lottery in one of the best, most efficient ways in the country? Where are they going to make money? And it's, as we've talked about, it's in one of a couple of areas. It's either going to be cheating seniors, it's going to be cheating players, or it's going to be cheating workers. That's how you're going to get to the bottom line. And my other big problem with, I have a problem with our lottery to begin with. I don't think we should be funding vital programs for our most beloved, our seniors, off of vice spending, off of tobacco settlements and off of gambling. It should be part of our budget. We shouldn't be, that should not be to the whims of do I have disposable dollar or don't I? But in this article, they pointed out a couple of things. And it's probably one of the better ways that I've thought of the whole privatization thing. The guy that they interviewed, this professor that they talked to, this Professor Fissman, he says, look, a good rule of thumb to determine when a private company will outperform the public sector is if the task is clear cut and it's possible to define concrete goals and reward those who meet them. The private sector would probably do better. If you have concrete, this is what you have to do, this is the task, this is the time frame, this is, everything's laid out, everything's specific. They're probably going to do it better. He goes on to say, he goes, look, but when these objects are more complex and diffuse, making it difficult to align profits with goals without undermining some desirable outcome, the profit motive could well make conflicts more difficult to manage. They say, in this case, privatization is probably not the best solution. In their rush to save money by outsourcing services, governments might forget that. And I see this exactly in what our governor is doing right now. It's a rush to, hey, let's get this out there. And hey, there's a possibility that we may end up having some measure of security that they may not be able to, they might never be able to meet. Look at Illinois. And the last one I have before we go to break. Why, if this is such a great deal, if privatizing this entity, if this is such a good deal, the one guy who was testifying said, oh, Pennsylvania seniors won the lottery. If this is such a sweetheart deal, why no light of day? Why no transparency? Why is it that you sign the deal and then you hold the first hearing days later? Why is it that I don't have input? Why is it that you don't have input? Why is it our elected officials didn't have any input? Reasons, simple. It's a bad deal. It's a screw job, not only for the seniors, for workers, but for you and me, the taxpayers. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. 97 crosses, planted in the cold ash yard. 97 families, who lost 97 farms.
Look out, the fixers are coming. top corporate chieftains and Wall Street gamblers want to tell Washington how to fix our national debt. So they've created a front group called Fix the Debt to push their agenda. Unfortunately, they're using fix in the same way your veterinarian uses it. Their core demand is for Washington to spay Social Security, castrate Medicare, and geld Medicaid. Of course, a group of pampered, narcissistic billionaires would not make a credible sales team for this dirty work. So Fix the Debt has recruited a bipartisan gaggle of former Congress critters to give their self-serving political gambit a softer public image, a sheen of high public purpose. With a budget of some $40 million, these elder statesmen are doing TV interviews, hosting breakfast sessions with members of Congress, making speeches about mutual sacrifice, and generally going all out to sell the financial elite's snake oil. But wait, being an elder does not automatically mean you're a statesman. Let's peek at the resumes of these so-called public-spirited fixers of the debt. Start with Jim McCreary, a former GOP lawmaker. While urging Congress to cut people's programs, he's also a top-paid lobbyist pushing Congress to give more tax subsidies to America's richest people and biggest multinational corporations. Former Democratic Senator Sam Nunn is a fixer, too, but he's also paid $300,000 a year to be a board director for General Electric. Likewise, Democrat Erskine Bowles, a co-founder of the Fixers Front Group, is on the board of Morgan Stanley, drawing $345,000 a year. And former GOP Senator Judd Gregg takes about $1 million a year as advisor to and board member of such giants as Goldman Sachs and Honeywell. This is Jim Hightower saying, I wouldn't want this gang of fixers to pet my dog, much less touch my Social Security.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
If this was done under Rendell's administration, the GOP would be jumping up and down like Rumpelstiltskin. I just want to make that point. I mean, the Republicans would be going nuts.
I'll go along with that. Completely disconnected from you and me and other folks who work for a living, but perfectly in tune with right-wing ideology. And that's what this is all about. It's pure ideology. There is no basis in my mind for this whatsoever. Last night we talked with former Revenue Secretary Tom Wolf, who said the same thing. As a businessman, as former Revenue Secretary, makes no sense. And like I said before, it's a bad idea. From top to bottom, just look at the way they rolled it out. Which is why I've asked my good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson, to come talk to us about this and, well, the theft of the 2016 election that I see coming up. Irwin, thanks for taking time for me.
Good to be here. How are you?
I am good. Bad idea, top to bottom, yes or no?
I don't think it's fair to even call it an idea. It's bad. It's bad policy. It's bad approaches. I mean, here we have this extraordinary business. You know, it's taken us 40 years to build the brand name of this business. We citizens of Pennsylvania, you know, the ones that own the business. And it's making money. It's a business that is bringing, you know, revenue of $3.4 billion a year with only 150 employees. You can't name me five private businesses that do nearly that well. So here we are, you know, from a pure business standpoint. You and I and our listeners here in Pennsylvania, we're all stockholders, shareholders in this very successful business. You know, one that has taken 40 years to build to this point, one that has an exclusive brand name, one that has something that every other business would just dream about,
yep.
A statutory, legal, required monopoly on the marketplace. Anybody other than the state that tries to sell, you know, a lottery will be arrested. But the state gets to do it, and we are the owners. And so what does this governor do? Under cover of darkness in a midnight raid, gives it away. Gives it away. This is nuts. This isn't a bad idea. This is fundamental insanity.
But it is exactly the right-wing ideology that there should be nothing that you and me and other taxpayers own collectively. Everything should be in the hands of the few, the people who sit at the top of the building in the corner office and collect the big paychecks.
Well, I don't know if it's ideology or if it's something else. I mean, it's nice to call it ideology, but I think, in all honesty, you're being too kind to these people. They're just devious, greedy so-and-sos. We're on the air, I'd use another word.
Yeah, of course. You know, but you bring up an interesting point, one that I've made a couple of times. You know, let's say we try this experiment, because this is what we're doing. This is an experiment. We've got a proven entity, and we're going to now try and experiment with something different. What happens in 3 years? Because I understand the detangling can happen in 3 years. What happens if they screw this up, and now we have no infrastructure left? All those people are gone. Everything's gone. What then?
What then is we will have, for the price of a couple of pieces of political gold to a handful of anti-people politicians, we will have squandered and frittered away this extraordinary asset that belongs to we the people. I'm not saying this as somebody who is an advocate for government ownership. I'm saying this as a capitalist, pure raw capitalism. Why would anybody give this up? And this isn't an experiment. An experiment is something where you try to put elements together to make something better. This is a disassembly, a dismantling, a wholesale giveaway of the public assets. You know, why don't we give away the highways? Let's give away the prisons. Maybe then after that we'll give away City Hall and give away the Capitol building. This is nuts. This is nuts.
Don't give them any ideas, Irwin.
Well, I don't think I have to give them any ideas. All I have to do is recognize that this is a group of people who think that the only appropriate role for government is to provide the police force, and maybe not that either.
I mean, you look down in Tennessee where they've got the for-profit, the private fire department that'll let your house burn to the ground if you didn't pay your bill.
Yep.
And the sad reality is I think that's our future if things like this are allowed to continue. Did you see the hearing, though?
Yeah.
The sham, the kangaroo hearing. I mean, I think it's a done deal. I understand there's some other wranglings going on, but they've already told you they signed the deal. Corbett's going to go full force if he can. In watching this, a couple of things struck me. One, that Camelot, the company who's going to be taking over our lottery, admitted that their operating costs are higher than the Commonwealth's. And two, they admitted that the prizes that they pay in the lottery that they run considerably lower than the prizes that we pay out here in Pennsylvania. So to me, when they take it over, expect higher operating costs and lower prizes.
Yeah, well, no, everything that ever gets privatized ends up costing us more, not less. And doing less, not more. This is nothing new. This is nothing shocking or surprising. The only thing that's shocking or surprising is, in the face of all the admissions, that this creep who has the colossal gall to refer to himself as the governor of the people does it. So, go figure. I can't figure it out except to understand. No, and just simply continue to be shocked by, maybe I'm Pollyanna, the greed and this extraordinary, endless appetite and capacity for taking something that belongs to you and me and giving it away to somebody else in return for the private political gain of a few pieces of gold, and that's all it is, and that's what they're doing. The Corbett contributors are getting a return on their investment at the expense of we the people. And I just can't help think, you know, in this time when we are seeing at the movie theaters this film about President Lincoln, and Daniel Day-Lewis is being nominated for Academy Awards and winning Golden Globe Awards. I can't help but think about that so well-known and often just maligned phrase that President Lincoln uttered about the government of the people, by the people, for the people. And here we are in Corbett land, a government of the political contributors, for the political contributors, by the political contributors, and the people be damned.
It's exactly what it is. And, you know, I've asked the question, and maybe you have a different idea on this. I've asked numerous people that we've had on this week. The way that it's being laid out to people is that this is going to guarantee certainty. They keep using that word guarantee. We're going to have guaranteed profits at this level for the next 20 years. It's guaranteed. So if next year nobody buys a lottery ticket, they're guaranteed $1.5 billion or $1 billion, whatever it's going to be. Are you seeing this? Because the way I'm reading it, not even close.
Oh, that's the biggest lie of all. The only thing that's guaranteed here is that we're losing our assets. Everything else is nothing. We're guaranteed that if Camelot makes a lot of money after they take care of themselves and pay all of the bills that they decide to unilaterally determine they're going to be, after they give themselves bonuses, after they give themselves raises, after they cut the pay of the people who have dedicated their careers to working for the citizens of Pennsylvania and delivering this extraordinarily successful business with fewer employees per dollar than any business to which I can point. The only thing that's guaranteed is that we might get the crumbs. This is the classic story of if you feed the elephants well, the sparrows may get something to eat in the end.
Excellent analogy.
Even this so-called deposit, this $200 million that is required to be deposited as part of this so-called deal, contract, in order to guarantee the income, that money is not accessible if they fail. A small portion of this is accessible if they fail on an annualized basis. The guarantee is that Camelot makes money. The people of Pennsylvania, the senior citizens who have come to depend upon the services that are financed by this public asset, their access to prescription drugs, their access to property tax and rent rebates, their access to transportation, their ability to get to the doctor's office, their capacity to get to the grocery store, all of that is guaranteed to be at risk. And Camelot is guaranteed to make money.
Yeah.
How could it possibly be that in an era when people tell us and have the colossal gall to tell us that their job in government as our elected leaders is to save us money, and then they, with full straight faces, in the context of a phony trumped-up hearing aimed at giving Corbett and the Corbettites cover for their illegal, unlawful, extra-constitutional conduct, how could they look us in the eye and say that they're doing this knowing full well that they're turning it over to people whose operating costs are higher because their efficiency is lower?
A lot easier with their pockets full.
Last
question I've got for you on this, because I want to get to this House Bill 94 as well. You know, one of the things that caught me in the hearing the other day is when Camelot was testifying. You know, the Commonwealth kept saying...
Is that what you called it? You call it testifying?
Well, the show that they were putting on. However you want to put it, with them sitting there pretending to answer questions, our people pretending to ask them questions. The administration's puppets kept saying, look, senior needs are going to go up. The programs that our seniors need, they're going to go up. So we've got to do something. And, you know, what the Camelot people, what caught me, and I don't know if you picked this up, but the woman was talking about how in the U.K., the profits from the lottery in the U.K. go to fund heritage programs and cultural programs, the arts, Olympics, and a whole bunch of programs like that. Yet we here in the Commonwealth use gambling and vice spending to fund programs for our most beloved, some of our most needy and most vulnerable. And to me, that just seemed kind of wrong.
Yeah, well, I did catch it, and you're very perceptive to have caught it as well. In the UK, they use these funds, and indeed, throughout the world, other than the United States, they use these gaming funds to enhance society, because those civilized countries have already made the fundamental commitment to the citizens who are dependent upon the government to do for them that which they cannot do for themselves. Access to health care in the UK is guaranteed to everybody as a right. Okay? I've often said on this show and other places that I actually live in a country where I have a right as under the Constitution to a lawyer, but I don't have a right to a doctor. There's something wrong with that. But here in Pennsylvania, 40 years ago, under the leadership of then-Senator Frank Mazzei, a great man from Pittsburgh where I grew up, and he happened to have been my state senator in my childhood in Pittsburgh, we came up with an understanding that if this country and this state wasn't doing what it was obliged to do for our seniors, that we would find a way to do it. And Frank Mazzei came up with the idea of the lottery, and he shepherded through the General Assembly and got it passed and put it into place. And we have worked then for 40 years building the brand. What, you know, a couple of weeks ago when Hostess was playing the game and blaming the union for the peccadilloes and avarice of their its corporate leaders, what was their goal? Their goal, of course, was to part it out and sell that valuable thing. The name, Hostess Twinkies, was the valuable asset. It wasn't anything anybody could wrap their arms around. You couldn't put it in your pocket. You couldn't build a factory with it. You couldn't operate your car with it. But, you know, that name was very valuable. Here we have a name, the Pennsylvania Lottery. And we're getting exactly nothing for the value of the 40 years it took us to invent, build, demonstrate, elevate that name.
And perfect.
And perfect it to a point where we are doing it with 150 people and $3.4 billion a year. In a real capitalistic world, we would, of course, be dividing that $3.4 billion a year among the 150 people. They're producing it, okay? They give up their right, their share to that, so that Pennsylvania seniors can have access to property tax and rent rebates, have access to prescription coverage, have access to transportation and paratransit. Only in this model can we do this, and only in Corbett land can we squander it and give it away. With it, compromise the future of our forefathers, of our forebears, of the people who got us to this point, of those who gave before us so that we could have a chance.
This is
not an idea. This is fundamental insanity. And were it unique in Corbett land, it would be very troublesome. But it's not unique. These are the people who want to divest the citizens of Pennsylvania of our wine and spirit shops. We've talked about that in past shows, who are dismantling public education, and with the dismantling and privatization of public education, squandering our future, our children's right to an education. So here we have it. We give away the future with our children. We give away our past with the compromise of our seniors who are supported by the lottery funds. What's left? What's left may be called West Virginia, Ohio, Maryland, New York, New Jersey, or Delaware, the states that surround us.
Yeah. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with my good friend, Attorney Irwin Aronson. You know, Irwin, I got a couple minutes left. Yesterday, I talked about this House Bill 94.
Yeah.
I've been waiting for it. I've been saying for, you know, the better part of a year, expect this is going to be the theft in 2016. This will be the scene of the crime. Lay it out for us.
Well, fundamentally, we have a group of politicians led by Senator Dominic Pileggi, the floor leader of the Republicans in the Senate, and aided and abetted again by the corporatites. It's not enough that they want to steal our assets from us. Now they have decided that since they can't put up a candidate that can win an election here in Pennsylvania for the presidency of the United States, that they will steal the election results. And instead of our electoral votes in the Electoral College going to the winner of the election in this state, they would be divided up in some lunatic formula so that even when the majority has spoken, the minority will get the votes. And that's just an effort, raw political insanity again, grievous, greedy insanity, stripping the people of the outcome of their own elections. But remember, these are the same people that brought us the voter ID law last year.
Right.
And they had no compunction about stealing the right of people to vote. Now, after they've stolen the right to vote, since they may be dissatisfied with the outcome of those who remain able to vote, that lesser number of Pennsylvanians who are otherwise qualified to vote, who are guaranteed by our Constitution the right to vote, maybe we'll just strip them of the outcome regardless of how they vote. And that's what this is about.
Yeah, and basically the way I put it yesterday, it is nothing but outright theft in my view. And, you know, the folks who have put it forth tell me they're conservatives. There's nothing conservative about this.
Oh, Rick, this is radical. This isn't conservative. Conservative, what is conservative? Conserve, retain, okay? A conservative would conserve the framework on which this state and this country was built. We have a history in Pennsylvania going back not to 1787 or 1776, but literally going back to Bill Penn in the late 1600s, when Pennsylvania was created as a halcyon, as a, you know, true and clear safeguarded place. And they're stripping us of it, and they're trying to do this in the course of a couple of years and suggest that the fact that Tom Corbett won an election in one election cycle gave them a mandate to destroy us, to take away our constitutional rights, to kill our children, to squander our assets, to abandon our seniors, and call it government. If anything but. And we know that Pileggi tried this last year, and we saw the reaction. So now they're going to try it again. They're offended that Barack Obama won Pennsylvania. They're offended with the outcome of an election. They're offended by the will of the people who pay their salaries and who built their building.
Which is why we need to be calling them and telling them what we think. It's that simple in my mind, and getting out into the streets. Irwin, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
I appreciate it, too. Good talk. We'll see you next week.
All righty. Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Beat up cars and drummers.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As auto companies in Detroit show off their shiny new autos of the future, auto workers were there to showcase the struggles of workers looking for brighter futures. Jesse Russell reports.
The Detroit Auto Show not only showed off the future of the auto industry, it also showcased the struggles of working people. A series of protests were held outside of the event throughout the weekend, highlighting everything from pushing back against Michigan's right-to-work law to unionizing Nissan plants in Mississippi. One woman at the anti-right-to-work rally this weekend said people need to stand up to corporate control.
The first thing is we have to overcome the fear that people have and the media message and the corporate message that we should all be glad we have a job and it doesn't matter what kind of conditions those jobs are.
One auto worker named Martin said one of the most important things labor could be doing right now is educating the next generation of workers.
If we can continue to educate and try to mobilize just not inside the plant but also outside the plant, let people know what's going on there, I think we had to be headed in the right direction.
A Korean labor union unhappy with a Hyundai Motors subcontractor has posted a petition on the White House We the People website. It calls on the Obama administration to pressure Hyundai to rehire temporary workers who were laid off. In Chicago, labor activists who support single-payer universal health care held their 2013 conference this week. Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis delivered the keynote speech. Lewis said the 2012 Chicago teachers' strike demonstrates the power of community solidarity as firefighters welcomed striking teachers into their homes for meals and parents also supported them. She says labor must attract and energize young people if it is to have a future. Lewis says as workers everywhere face another year of struggles, community coalitions and solidarity is crucial and workers need to take the fight to the streets of communities nationwide.
We need to continue to build coalitions. Labor alone cannot win this fight. If we don't have community with us, we will be irrelevant quickly. If we don't continue to energize our ranks, to me, the beauty of our strike was that there were so many people without a single strand of gray hair. Regardless of where you are, you still have more to do, as do we all. It can't be a bunch of phone calls, brothers and sisters, face to face, one at a time, person to person. Stop preaching to the choir, take off those robes, and get in the streets.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org. Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
Ladies, criminate my race and hate. Won't pay nobody a living wage. Warlords here, let's all rejoice. Everyone is gone and we got no choice. So more hard.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So Walmart getting a ton of positive press over this. They're going to hire more than 100,000 veterans, and also they're going to buy more U.S.-made goods. And I go, well, you know, maybe they've had a change of heart. Maybe they've seen the ills of their ways as being the leader in making sure that a lot of companies end up in China. Maybe they've seen the ills of their ways. Or maybe... maybe this is just a PR ploy. And I like what the Carlisle Sentinel, the Brain Trust over at the Carlisle Sentinel, their editorial board had to say. Their first line is, while some cynics call Walmart's plan to hire more than 100,000 veterans a ploy to get free publicity, the retailer ought to be commended for its move. And they asked the question, will a lot of vets take advantage of the offer? They say, well, time will tell. Walmart's wages and benefits might not offer long-term solutions to vets. So for me, I would go, okay, well, you're going to hire the vets. How about hiring them at a decent wage? Just a thought. But I've asked Josh Idelson, who has written extensively on Walmart and the organizing going on there, to come talk to us about this offer and what it means. Josh, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me back, Rick.
So, ploy or just a good heart?
Well, unfortunately, I'm sad to say you're going to have to count me among the cynics. Certainly, there is a higher unemployment rate among veterans than among other groups in the country. Certainly, that is a shameful thing. But there are all kinds of reasons to look at this announcement from Walmart with skepticism. One, as Time Magazine pointed out, is that the 20,000 veterans a year that Walmart says it will be hiring actually would not even be enough for Walmart to be hiring as many veterans proportionately as it is people that aren't veterans. So if that 100,000 over 5 year figures hold, if that's what's achieved, then Walmart would be hiring less than a third of the number of veterans it would need to just be hiring them at the same rate as the rest of the population proportionately.
Right. This is a company that's got, what, 2.2 million employees?
Walmart has, in the United States, 1.4 million U.S. employees. It hires about 480,000 people a year, according to its figures. Meanwhile, AOL asked about, well, why are they excluding people who were discharged prior to today, and the response they got from a Walmart spokesperson was, we shouldn't be given a hard time about this.
We shouldn't ask for details. Just tell us how wonderful you are, and we'll report that, right?
Exactly. Exactly. Now, in my reporting for The Nation, I was there. I heard Walmart's president, Bill Simon, make this announcement on Tuesday. I talked to folks who were protesting outside. I also talked to a worker I've talked to in the past who was in the Navy for 2 years, went to work at the Walmart in Tulsa, Oklahoma, the Supercenter. And he said, well, unfortunately, you come to work there. And in his words, you're still subject to all the crap that comes from working for Walmart. Now, when he said this, what he was talking about is the wages that keep you substantially below the poverty line. He was talking about the benefits, the experiences you go through, like mandatory anti-union captive audience meeting that he was subjected to. And so the bigger conversation here should be not just, well, how much of a change is this in Walmart's policy in terms of who they're hiring, but how much of a good job are we talking about? How much of a family income are we talking about? And so what workers who are veterans and who aren't veterans have pointed out is people deserve much better than these jobs.
Absolutely.
Veterans deserve better. Everybody deserves better than these jobs. Jobs where the Huffington Post disclosed based on documents they obtained that you could work there 6 years, be a solid performer in the company's words, receive a promotion, and you're likely to make $10.60 after 6 years.
Wow. That's is that enough to make a, to I don't even know that's enough for me to live on myself, let alone raise a family of two or three or four.
That's right. That's right. And it should be pointed out, Walmart, anecdotally, already, and based on the scholarship of Nelson Lichtenstein, already hired quite a few veterans. In fact, the worker I talked to who was in the Navy said 7 out of about 20 people on his shift are veterans.
Well, let me ask you about that. Let me ask you about that because, you know, there's got to be, for me, because, again, like you, I'm very cynical of this. There's got to be some subsidy, some payday in them, in this for them to go along with the good PR. There's got to be some cash at the end of the line for this.
You know, it has been asked by one of the other outlets that brought a little scrutiny to this, what this means in terms of tax benefits for Walmart, what this means, whether Walmart is less likely to end up having to pay for health benefits for people who come out of the Army and go to work at Walmart. And these are all worthwhile questions that haven't been fully addressed. What Lichtenstein has argued, and this is, again, speaking to the perception the company has, not necessarily to what it actually means to go to work at Walmart as a veteran. But he argued, and Bill Simon basically said it himself, that the company likes to hire veterans because they see them as people who will be comfortable with a hierarchy and following instructions and acting with discipline. And you can read that in a friendly way, or you can read that in a more suspicious way.
As anti-union.
Well, what Simon said is we're looking for people who are going to act with discipline. And we need that in our company. He said more specifically he wants people with who are leaders with discipline and have a purpose who are instilled in them. We need that in our business. So
in essence, what you're saying is people willing to play Simon Says.
Well, given Walmart's track record, given the way that they've responded to workers raising issues about staffing, that is certainly would be a reasonable conclusion, just as Barbara Ehrenreich reported after working at Walmart, that they use personality tests to try to screen out people who speak up with themselves.
Right.
Now, that doesn't mean that Walmart is correct. That doesn't mean that bringing people in who've been veterans means bringing people in who won't stand up for themselves. But Walmart has given ample reason to believe that that is part of what motivates the company.
So a lot of this could be taken from the current uprising of a number of workers around the country, and from what I hear, a lot more workers who work for Walmart around the country saying, hey, we want a decent wage. We want to share in some of the profits that we're sending to the top.
Well, That would certainly be one conclusion one would draw, would be that Walmart is redoubling its efforts to find workers who it believes will not rock the boat. More generally, though, Walmart had made a quite dramatic effort on Tuesday to improve its public image on a few fronts. And I think absolutely it's not a coincidence that Walmart is doing that when it faces scrutiny from the media that was instigated by the ongoing scrutiny and protest it's getting from its own employees. So whether it's this effort around hiring veterans, this claim that they're going to be sourcing more of their goods from the U.S., this claim, which didn't get as much media attention but has been a major focus from workers, that they're going to do something about their scheduling and the difficulty of getting a predictable or full-time schedule, all of that is reasonable to trace back to the protests that we've been seeing from Walmart workers and the strikes that we've been seeing from Walmart workers in recent months.
So this is, as I've been saying, an example of, you know, actually people coming together, getting out in the streets, rattling the cage a little bit, them trying to throw a bone. But this is not the time to stop. And this is the time to be pushing forward, because if they're willing to go this far, you can push them further.
Right. And it should be said, there's a lot that we don't know about what Walmart is suggesting. So,
right.
For example, they've said they're going to make it easier for part-time workers to find full-time positions, that they're going to make their scheduling more transparent. But in Bill Simon's speech, all this was framed as an extension of or a clarification of what they're already doing. And what they're already doing, workers have been very clear, is not good enough. So it's going to take some time to see the fine print, but certainly our Walmart, the union-backed group that's been pushing these issues, has chosen to be at least a bit cautiously optimistic that with accountability, with further pressure, we could be seeing the beginning of at least a mild improvement in some of the conditions that workers have been crying out about.
Because what I've been saying, Josh, is that we've got to make this generation of jobs, you know, like we did 100 years ago, making the mining jobs and the factory jobs and the textile jobs and all of those jobs of that era. We made those middle class jobs. We need to make this generation of those kind of jobs, the retail, the fast food, the home health care stuff. Those jobs, those have got to be jobs that we can exist on and maybe even have a living on.
That's right, and that's why it's short-sighted when people say, oh, that these workers should just go somewhere else. You could have said the same thing to workers in the auto industry 100 years ago, or to workers in the sweatshops making shirts 100 years ago. The truth is, there was not another place to go. People had to change those jobs. And while Walmart is particularly egregious in various ways, Walmart is dragging the rest of the industry in its direction, and several of its competitors, like a Target, may be smaller, but don't have dramatically different working conditions. And this is one aspect of Walmart's defense of itself that has some truth to it, is that their wages aren't so much lower than many of their competitors. The issue is that Walmart is the one dragging the whole industry in that direction. And so the question is, can people draw a line in the sand and change these jobs? Or are we going to see that drag continue and that trend continue within retail, within supermarkets, and within other industries in the United States?
Yeah, because I go back, and I've talked about this a number of times. My grandmother back in, you know, the 50s, 60s, 70s, and up until the 80s, you know, worked in retail. And, you know, when she retired in 1985, she was making $8 an hour with 6 weeks vacation, full medical, dental, you know, sick days, paid holidays, you know, all of that stuff, overtime on weekends and all kinds of stuff that the Walmarts and the Targets and the Kmarts and all the retail of today, they've given up years ago.
Right. People fought for a very long time to secure some of these benefits. And the struggles that union members had for things like defined benefit pensions lifted up even the standards for non-union workers in their industries. Unfortunately, what we're seeing to a great extent now is the opposite, that even what union members have, say, in Southern California groceries, has been chipped away at by the competitive pressure from Walmart.
Yep.
And that's one of the many reasons that we see a union like the UFCW investing a tremendous amount in supporting these organizing efforts, is that it is a question of either the non-union standard, the Walmart standard, is going to go up, or the Walmart example, the Walmart pressure, is going to continue to drag the standards, even for unionized workers, down.
Yeah. Last line of questioning I've got for you, the $5 billion a year in U.S. Products that they plan to sell in their stores. To me, $5 billion for a company as large as that is a drop in the bucket.
Well, what they're saying is $50 billion.
Over 10 years.
Billion.
Oh, I thought it was over 10 years. $5
right,
billion a year.
Right. So that $50 billion over 10 years, it is a drop in the bucket. And, in fact, Christopher Matthews at Time made the point that the numbers don't really add up if you see this as a projection of what's going to be different. Because Walmart also said, Bill Simon said over and over, I mean, the real theme of his speech for Tuesday in many ways was that people just don't know how good Walmart already is. So he claimed that Walmart currently sources two-thirds of its products from the United States. Now, the point that was made at Time by Matthews is that if you add up the numbers, what Walmart is talking about would mean less sourcing from the United States than they claim that they already do.
Interesting.
So the argument that Matthews made at Time is, well, maybe this is just about setting a very low bar so that then they can exceed it. But either way, given the humongous creature that Walmart is, what they're talking about is really quite modest. And the lack of further disclosure is a greater issue. In fact, if what we're concerned about is not just what country the goods are made in, but what conditions the goods are made in, what Walmart should be doing is disclosing where it makes these. Because one of the consistent complaints of human rights groups is Walmart's failure to say which factories its individual products are being made in so that we can evaluate not just what country are they sourced from, but which of these are sweatshops.
Now, and at least give consumers the opportunity to know where this stuff's coming from and what conditions it's being made under. Because, you know, one of the things we keep hearing from the Walmarts, well, lower prices, better living. In fact, that's one of their slogans. But under what conditions and for who suffer?
Right. And as we know, as folks at Demos and elsewhere have pointed out, it is not true that you have to either choose between low prices for working class people, or are we going to instead, rather than low prices, have decent wages for working class people at Walmart? We could have both.
Yeah.
The example of other countries shows that of other employers of other countries shows that we could have both, and the numbers show that we had both. If, in fact, Demos pointed out that if Walmart just took the money that it spends repurchasing its own stock and devoted that to paying its workers better, then we could be talking about Walmart workers who make $25,000 a year. Still, not a family-sustaining income, but more than what, according to IBIS World, people are bringing in now.
Yeah, one of the studies I read, if they raised the price of their socks a penny, just socks, they could give all their employees a living wage. It's one of those things, man. Josh, it's always great talking with you. I appreciate the time.
Thank you very much, Rick.
Josh Edelson, contributing editor over at the Nation. Quick break, back with hour two. Stick around. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
While the poor man pays the man, oh, there's still me. For killing me. Lord have mercy on the working man.
Proudly blue in an ocean of red. Rick Smith.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As auto companies in Detroit show off their shiny new autos of the future, auto workers were there to showcase the struggles of workers looking for brighter futures. Jesse Russell reports.
The Detroit Auto Show not only showed off the future of the auto industry, it also showcased the struggles of working people. A series of protests were held outside of the event throughout the weekend, highlighting everything from pushing back against Michigan's right-to-work law to unionizing Nissan plants in Mississippi. One woman at the anti-right-to-work rally this weekend said people need to stand up to corporate control.
The first thing is we have to overcome the fear that people have. And the media message and the corporate message that we should all be glad we have a job and it doesn't matter what kind of conditions those jobs are.
One auto worker named Martin said one of the most important things labor could be doing right now is educating the next generation of workers.
If we can continue to educate and try to mobilize just not inside the plant but also outside the plant, let people know what's going on, then I think we have to be heading in the right direction.
A Korean labor union unhappy with a Hyundai Motors subcontractor has posted a petition on the White House We the People website. It calls on the Obama administration to pressure Hyundai to rehire temporary workers who were laid off. In Chicago, labor activists who support single-payer universal health care held their 2013 conference this week. Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis delivered the keynote speech. Lewis said the 2012 Chicago teachers' strike demonstrates the power of community solidarity as firefighters welcomed striking teachers into their homes for meals, and parents also supported them. She says labor must attract and energize young people if it is to have a future. Lewis says as workers everywhere face another year of struggles, community coalitions and solidarity is crucial, and workers need to take the fight to the streets of communities nationwide.
We need to continue to build coalitions. Labor alone cannot win this fight. If we don't have community with us, we will be irrelevant quickly. If we don't continue to energize our ranks, to me, the beauty of our strike was that there were so many people without a single strand of gray hair. Regardless of where you are, you still have more to do, as do we all. It can't be a bunch of phone calls, brothers and sisters, face to face, one at a time, person to person. Stop preaching to the choir, take off those robes, and get in the streets.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and from OPEIU. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Exposing GOP hypocrisy. The Rick Smith Show.
Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So the big issue, the guns issue, the president laid out in this press conference what his idea is. And you look at some of the stuff on the far right, the guy with the Gun Appreciation Day guy, Larry Ward, saying that, guns are a civil right issue. In fact, slavery wouldn't have happened if slaves had guns. MLK would have been in favor of according to him. And now you see this guy, Eric Pratt, the Gun Owners of America, saying basically that when Reagan came around to the idea that we should have some gun controls, a little bit of safety, that it was because he was senile. It was later in his life, later in his life after he was shot. I think being shot would kind of make me rethink that idea. Just a thought. But to talk about the gun issue, because, we hear a lot from the radical right. We hear a lot from folks who are out of my cold, dead hands. We hear a lot of irrational statements. I wanted to get something from the other side, which I've asked Brian Multy, Director of Mobilization for the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, to come talk to us. Brian, thanks for taking time for me.
Rick, thanks for having me.
So we hear a lot of this vitriol. We hear a lot of this, out of my cold, dead hands. There's got to be some common sense ground here where we all can go, hey, I don't want criminals with AK-47s. I don't want AR-15s on every street corner. There's got to be some common ground here.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, first off, we, wholeheartedly support the White House's recommendations that the president and the vice president are really leading a conversation that Americans want to have right now. And we've been very proud to been asked to by the White House to supply solutions and pleased to see a lot of these solutions reflected in today's announcement. And we look forward to continuing to work with the administration and helping be the voice of the American people to get the common sense solutions, to keep dangerous people away from dangerous guns. And, you know, it's very interesting that a lot of people think we have all these gun laws on the books, and in fact, we don't. There's basically three federal gun laws on the books, but we don't have those. And the other side will make you think, well, we have all these laws on the books and they don't work. Well, we don't have them, and we need them. Just to give you a quick idea of something I think is very important is that 40% of all gun sales in this country go unchecked. Cash and carry, no questions asked, military-style assault weapons, as many as you can buy from gun shows over the Internet, without a background check. And that surprises most people. And that's one of the proposals we saw today, the universal background check. It's a very simple thing to do and can save a lot of lives.
Yeah, but, you know, there's now some would argue that, well, you just can't possibly regulate that. You couldn't possibly regulate the sale of guns over the Internet or person to person. How would that work?
Well, actually, it's already done in Rhode Island and California. In California, where one out of every eight Americans lives, and there's plenty of hunters and sportsmen. Basically, what it is any sale or transfer of a gun must go through a federally licensed dealer, and that transfer has to take place there. When that transfer takes place there, a criminal background check is done. And when a criminal background check is done, if you pass, you get it. If you don't pass it, you don't get it. It's actually a very simple approach that's been in place for over 20 years. And like I said, you know, hunters hunt and sports shooters still sports shoot. So it's a relatively easy thing to implement.
Just to get this right, maybe I'm wrong, but you're not advocating that no one should have guns. We're not talking about people, law-abiding citizens. You're not saying that they don't have the right to own a gun, or am I getting that wrong?
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, there is a Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms, and that's been settled. It's been settled by the Supreme Court, but it doesn't run afoul, and there's certainly a lot of space for reasonable and sensible gun regulations. Even Justice Scalia, you know, who wrote the majority opinion on the Heller decision on the Second Amendment, said that there's plenty of room and plenty of space for these reasonable gun regulations like background checks and all gun sales.
Let me walk back to the Brady campaign to begin with, because maybe a lot of people don't remember, because, you know, I brought up the fact that, you know, Reagan actually did, if I remember this correctly, as governor, signed a 15-day waiting period. I guess wasn't so thrilled with it on the federal level. But came later in life after being shot along with the person who this who the Brady campaign is named after, came to the idea that maybe we should have some safety.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, certainly Jim Brady, press secretary for Ronald Reagan, as you mentioned, was injured in the shooting assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan. And obviously, when, you know, people know somebody who's been shot or injured, which is, you know, basically one out of three Americans know someone who's been shot or killed or been affected themselves, you know, it has an effect on you, and it had an effect on President Reagan. But we also know that President Ford and even President Bush Senior, did things to say we need to keep, do more to keep dangerous guns out of the hands of dangerous people. So it's, you know, look, a bullet doesn't have a party affiliation. You know, Republicans, Democrats, independents, we're all affected by gun violence every day across this country. So it should never be just a one-party issue. It should be a bipartisan issue.
Yeah, I mean, because I think universally people agree we don't want criminals having access to these guns, and I don't know that I want people having military armaments. I don't, you know, and I know people keep saying, well, you know, sometimes we need to, you know, water the tree of liberty with the blood of patriots and that. I'm sorry, I think the cat's out of the bag on that. I think it's over. We can't really compete with the military because I don't have a stealth bomber or a nuclear bomb. I just think that's kind of short-sighted.
Yeah, I mean, look, we all, as there's a right to keep and bear arms, there's also a right to live in peace and safety and in our communities. And, you know, weapons of war like military-style assault weapons certainly aren't a part of that. I mean, you have folks in the military say, I was in the military. I know what these weapons are about. They don't belong on our streets. They belong on the battlefield. And, you know, it's just too easy to get these sorts of weapons. And, again, too easy to get these sort of weapons all sometimes in most places in this country, 40% of the time, without a background check. So it's that easy to get these kind of guns and as many of them as you want.
Yeah, but I have people who tell me, and I have friends who say, I don't want to have to go through that. I don't want the government knowing anything or where my guns are or any of this stuff. And there's this among some, and it's not all. There are some very level-headed folks who are gun owners who say, look, you know, there's got to be some reasonable restrictions. There's got to be something here that makes sure that, you know, honest, decent, law-abiding citizens are the ones who have it, and we don't have criminals walking around with it. But there's got to be something there. Is that fear irrational? Is it something that you think we should have to worry about?
No, I mean, look, I mean, here's the bottom line is Frank Luntz, and for those of your listeners who are familiar with that name, is a very prominent Republican pollster, you know, no liberal.
Wordsmith, guru.
Right? Yeah, and he did a poll that shows that 74% of NRA members support requiring criminal background checks on all gun sales. So there you have it. I mean, you know, what? There's not much that polls in this country to that extent. And we're talking NRA members support universal background checks. Because when you give it to them straight, you know, like, this is what we're talking about. This is that simple. It's like, hey, wait, I thought we already had them, but we don't have them. And I'm an NRA member. This makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, because I actually thought you had to go through a background check. It surprised me when I found out 40% of the guns that change hands, no background check.
That's right. That's right. I mean, some states do a better job than others, but as a country as a whole, 40% of the time, you can go into a place like a gun show on the internet, flea market, garage sale, get virtually any kind of weapon you want, and no background check. And all we're talking about the background check is, look, are you dangerously mentally ill? Are you a felon? Are you a fugitive from justice? And do you have a domestic violence restraining order against you? And if so, you don't get a gun. And if you're not, you get your gun. It's that simple.
What do you say to the people who are concerned about the pulling mental illness in this, that it's going to maybe stop people from getting treatment, could actually make the problem worse?
Well, look, I mean, there, you know, the way the federal law is adjudicated by a court, mentally ill, severely mentally ill, meaning a danger to yourself or others. And what's happening is that's already the law. It's been the law since 1968. It's just that a lot of states don't do a good job of getting the records into the system. We need to do a better job of that. We're already dealing with that law. It's just that if the records aren't in the system, you run a background check, and if the record's not in there, the person's going to pass, even though they've been adjudicated by a court mentally ill.
And going back to the assault weapons ban, which I thought should have been left in place, because, again, I don't believe people should have military armaments. I don't think the AK-47s or any of the – I just don't think that you need that for hunting or home protection. I don't know what you're protecting. Would that have stopped some of the shootings that we've had recently? I mean, you know, there's talk – well, it wouldn't have done anything. It hasn't stopped any – and I had a gun friend of mine who said there hasn't been, you know, one case where, you know, legal, law-abiding citizens who have gone through those processes have used these guns. What do you say to that?
Well, look, I mean, assault weapons and military-style weapons have been used recently. The AR-15 was used in the Aurora movie theater shooting.
But that wasn't his, was it?
What's that?
That wasn't his. I thought it was his mother's.
Right, but what I'm saying is if those weapons are available, they are used. They
okay.
are used in these sorts of crimes. And, you know, when they are used to kill a lot of people in a short amount of time. And extended magazines that can hold, you know, like the Aurora shooter had a 100-round drum.
Wow.
You know, he's shooting 100 bullets as fast as his finger can pull the trigger, and he doesn't need to reload. I think most people would agree that's not a good thing. That's something you see on the battlefield in wars. You don't see, you know, in Aurora, Colorado, or in a movie theater.
So as director of mobilization at the Brady Campaign to Prevent Gun Violence, the website bradycampaign.org, what are you doing? Because I got to be honest with you, I'm not hearing your side of it. I'm hearing a lot of the pro-gun people. I'm hearing a lot of gun advocates. In fact, Gun Appreciation Day is coming up. I'm not hearing anything from a rational standpoint, and I'm not even hearing really much from the far other side of we need to take all guns off the street and wipe everything out. The message I'm hearing is mostly we need my cold, dead hands.
Well, it's interesting from our standpoint. The American public is fully engaged, and it's clearly a discussion the American public wants to have, and you'll see that over the coming weeks and months. our organization has been flooded with people, ordinary Americans who want to volunteer. We've got phone calls and emails from NRA members who are very upset that the NRA is not engaging in the same conversation the rest of the American public seems to want to have and is starting to have. And you know what? It really is going to take the American public to engage. If the American public doesn't engage, there will be no change. And that's why we at the Brady Campaign created the wearebetterthanthis.org website, where it's a place that you can go and make your voice heard. You can share your story. You can sign up. And, you know, I encourage all your listeners and everyone to sign up because change isn't going to happen alone. And, you know, we're against a tough foe in the gun lobby, but we can win. I mean, when you have 74% of NRA members saying we need universal background checks on all gun sales, you know you're tapping into something. You know that that's what their members want and ordinary Americans want. So people got to speak up and let their elected officials know where they stand.
Well, that's a line of questioning. You look at the NRA, and I guess this is just like a personal question. Have they lost their mind? I mean, the ad that they ran, the positions that they've taken, this isn't the NRA of just 10 or 20 years ago. I mean, these folks are radical. Is it that they're that aligned with the manufacturers, or is it just that they've really just lost their mind?
Well, they are aligned with the manufacturers. And, you know, the NRA is counting, and the gun lobby is counting on the American people saying, well, we were outraged for a little while after Aurora and Newtown, but you know what? We're going back to our normal lives. I've been doing this for 17 years. I've never seen anything like this. The outpouring of volunteerism, people wanting to do something, is unprecedented. And, you know, here in Washington, D.C., we see a lot of mobilization happening amongst groups that haven't been quite tuned into this issue before or a lot or since the Brady Bill, who are very well reengaged. And I think you'll see over the next days and months and weeks that there's a huge change and there's going to be a huge outcry, but it really is up to the American public to speak out.
I'm with you. I'd love to have you back as this continues down the road, Brian. I appreciate the time.
Sounds good, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
The website is wearebetterthanthis.org. We've got a link at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Brian Malti's name. It'll take you right there. Quick break, right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Can make America better. The Rick Smith Show.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Look out! The fixers are coming. Top corporate chieftains and Wall Street gamblers want to tell Washington how to fix our national debt. So they've created a front group called Fix the Debt to push their agenda. Unfortunately, they're using fix in the same way your veterinarian uses it. Their core demand is for Washington to spay Social Security, castrate Medicare, and geld Medicaid. Of course, a group of pampered, narcissistic billionaires would not make a credible sales team for this dirty work. So Fix the Debt has recruited a bipartisan gaggle of former Congress critters to give their self-serving political gambit a softer public image, a sheen of high public purpose. With a budget of some $40 million, these elder statesmen are doing TV interviews, hosting breakfast sessions with members of Congress, making speeches about mutual sacrifice, and generally going all out to sell the financial elites snake oil. But wait, being an elder does not automatically mean you're a statesman. Let's peek at the resumes of these so-called public-spirited fixers of the debt. Start with Jim McCreary, a former GOP lawmaker. While urging Congress to cut people's programs, he's also a top-paid lobbyist pushing Congress to give more tax subsidies to America's richest people and biggest multinational corporations. Former Democratic Senator Sam Nunn is a fixer, too, but he's also paid $300,000 a year to be a board director for General Electric. Likewise, Democrat Erskine Bowles, a co-founder of the Fixers Front Group, is on the board of Morgan Stanley, drawing $345,000 a year. And former GOP Senator Judd Gregg takes about $1 million a year as advisor to and board member of such giants as Goldman Sachs and Honeywell. This is Jim Hightower saying, I wouldn't want this gang of fixers to pet my dog, much less touch my Social Security.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
If you take a what I would call a reasonable scientific approach to that, we believe those consequences are manageable. They do require us to begin to exert or spend more policy effort on adaptation. And as human beings, as a species, that's why we're all still here. We have spent our entire existence adapting. Okay, so we will adapt to this.
Yes. Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil. We'll adapt. We'll figure it out. He's talking about climate change. And I guess you could make that argument to anything. We can adapt. I mean, we got people go running around shooting folks. We can adapt. We can fix that. Yeah. We have the ability to fix things. It's called smart policy. Just a thought. I don't know if you've seen this, but last night blew my mind. In talking with the guns, I just think the NRA has completely lost their mind. And if there are any NRA members, love to talk to you. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. I got to play the audio from this NRA ad. I mean, it really left me dumbfounded.
Are the president's kids more important than yours? Then why is he skeptical about putting armed security in our schools when his kids are protected by armed guards at their school? Mr. Obama demands the wealthy pay their fair share of taxes, but he's just another elitist hypocrite when it comes to a fair share of security, protection for their kids, and gun-free zones for ours.
Ooh, what ominous noises. I mean, where do you begin with that? I'm not quite sure where the wealthy elite, you know, where they pay their fair. I'm not sure where that comes from, other than that you got to pay homage to the wealth class. This thing that, well, his kids get armed guards. His kids didn't ask for dad to be president. His kids didn't ask to be the targets of potential abductions by who knows. Numerous foreign country, who knows? So, this idea, well, his kids got, his kids can't go run outside and play catch. His kids can't do a lot of things. But beyond that, pulling the kids into it is disgusting as it is. It doesn't surprise me. It's how far, how radical the NRA has become. How far from the mainstream they have become. Well, he gives us gun-free zones. And maybe it's just because I pay attention. But I remember in the days after the Columbine shootings, after they made their decision to hold their convention in Denver, the National Rifle Association, right around the corner from where the shooting took place, I remember pretty vividly that they were in favor of gun-free zones and in favor of closing the gun show loophole, something that now, just 14 years later, well, 13 in some months, complete opposite, completely against it. Not only the gun-free zones, but the loophole. And you look at the fact, as Brian pointed out, 40% of gun sales in this country, no background checks. Nothing. We don't know. Back in 99, LaPierre said, well, the NRA believes felons should get no guns any month. Nothing. But now we're seeing things a little differently. And why is that? I truly believe it's everything you can do, all of the fear, all of the demagoguing, just to drum up sales. Just to get people all worked up, and I like what I'm not a huge fan of of Joe Scarborough, but I think he was spot on.
The big lie that the NRA is pushing on gun owners to try to whip stupid people into a frenzy is they're coming to take your guns away. And I say stupid people because you have to be stupid in 2013 to believe that the federal government can come and take your handguns or come and take your shotguns. You have to be stupid.
Yeah. Representative Bob Goodlatte, Republican from Virginia. He was on C-SPAN's Washington Journal. And he was asked the question about, and we talked about this extensively while the Republican National Convention was going on. But he was asked the question why the RNC didn't allow people to carry concealed weapons into the convention hall. And, you know, the question was, didn't that limit their freedom? And Goodlatte said, you know, as you know, a lot of the candidates for president of the United States have Secret Service protection. And once you're inside, they want to provide protection to these folks. And when you go to a presidential rally, you probably are not allowed to carry a weapon into those events or that are attended by the president or the vice president, because they protect those people. And again, you leave the kids aside because they're part of that. You look at the number of gun shows going on, and Scott Kies over at Think Progress has done some excellent work on this, where in January he looked at 51 of these gun shows. And of the 51 that he looked at, which I guess are, you know, everyone he could find, they all ban the folks who come to them from carrying loaded guns on the premises, even if they have concealed permits. And as he points out in one of his pieces, the Crossroads Gun Show, they had a statement that said, "We respectfully request that you do not bring any loaded firearm into the gun show. Safety is our number one priority. And a safe environment in the show can only be maintained if there are no loaded guns in the show." Am I missing something? I mean, you're talking about gun people. These are all the gun people coming with their guns. It's a gun fest. It's like Gunapalooza. But leave your guns at home. And going back to the Tampa thing, I remember, you know, there were a lot of things that you couldn't have outside. Outside the convention that made me chuckle, you couldn't have string or cardboard tubes or squirt guns, but you could have a loaded gun outside. Not inside where the politicians are, but outside where the rabble is. It was a clear defining line. No, no, we don't want guns around us, not near the ruling class. No, no, you people, you, the unwashed masses, the rabble, you can have guns out there and you fight among yourselves. And I look at this and I go, you know, this is another one of those dividing lines that they throw at us. And I truly believe we're all, the vast majority of people in this country are in the same area of thought that I'm at. Look, I'm cognizant of the fact that there are very different views based on where you grew up, where you live. There's the urban view, there's the rural view. As a kid growing up in an urban area, in a housing project, the only time I ever saw someone use a gun, the only hunting that went on in my neighborhood was somebody. People got shot, people got killed. That's what I saw gun use for. Now, I understand you go into the rural areas and you go, "Oh, we went out back and we were shooting at tin cans." I get that. And I don't want to take that away. But understand, there are differences. And the problem is the dividers, they play on that. And I say, "Well, you know, they want to take your..." No, nobody wants to take anyone's guns. We want to make sure that criminals don't get them. We want to make sure people who are going to use them they don't get them. But nobody's taking them. Now, you got a .22 and you're going to go out back and you're going to shoot some tin cans, or you're going to go target shooting or deer hunting or whatever it is you do, God bless you. But understand that there are differences. And for me, I think, you know, I look at some of the polling numbers that are out. And in fact, the ABC Washington Post poll was conducted between January 10th to the 13th. And, you know, they came up with 65% of the people support a nationwide ban on high-capacity clips. Seems pretty simple to me. 88% in the one poll by the ABC Washington Post, 88% require background checks by people who buy guns and guns at gun shows. The Pew Research people did another one right around the same time. 85% of their polled found, hey, background checks. Polling pretty much across the board in line. You know, 55% favor an assault weapons ban. 54% favor doing away with high-capacity ammunition clips. Most people are getting it. And I think, as Brian pointed out, actual gun owners, you know, nearly 90% of the NRA in the one poll agree that, you know, support for the Second Amendment goes hand in hand with keeping guns out of the hands of criminals. So who are those other 10%? Who are those 10% who don't see that? Well, I would argue probably the people running the NRA. And oddly enough, 75% in this one poll put out by the mayors against illegal guns, 75% of NRA members support criminal background checks for anyone buying a gun. You know, you look at this and you go, who are these handfuls? Well, they're the people who run the big companies. They're the people who make the big money. You know, you whip people up into a frenzy. You get people all lathered up. They stop talking. They start shouting. They stop listening. And they keep shouting. We're at a point where, and I think this is the problem with our entire political system, that we're not listening to each other. We're not listening to ideas. We're all shouting. And the sad reality is a lot of the things that people are shouting at each other or past each other are nothing but talking points and platitudes and factually inaccurate misinformation pieces. Sound bites. Oh, I heard this little clip. And what you've got is you've got a moneyed interest. I mean, understand, the NRA is a huge moneyed interest. You've got a moneyed interest who their job is misinformation. Their job is to keep this friction. Because if it's settled, if we decide that, you know, we need to do things, they become irrelevant. And I know, as a parent, I don't ever want to turn on the news or get that phone call that somebody went into a school and had and shot my kid. Or my kid was walking home and two idiots were arguing and were throwing shots at each other. Now, I'm in favor of universal background checks. I'm in favor of really stringent, really strict, really heavy sentences for people who use guns in a crime. But there's a lot of things that we're not allowed to talk about. And I'm hoping, as the days and weeks come on, as we have this conversation, now that Obama has put forth his plan, his ideas, maybe we can have those thoughts. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death, no one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Earth, sky.
Astronomers have discovered a new comet. It's out beyond Jupiter's orbit now, but it's heading for a close encounter with the Sun in 2013.
Its official name is C-2012 S1 Ison, but we've heard some astronomers call it just plain Comet Ison for the International Scientific Optical Network in Russia, where scientists discovered it. Its orbital characteristics indicate it might become a very bright object in Earth's sky beginning in November of 2013.
Comets have a mystique. Once considered omens of doom, they're now known as icy visitors from the outer solar system that sweep near our sun, then disappear again into the depths of space. People get excited about comets. This comet will be no exception.
In November of 2013, Comet Ison will pass less than 1.8 million kilometers, about 1.1 million miles, from the surface of the sun. That sounds like a lot, but it's actually very close, over 100 times closer to the sun than Earth is. Unless its close sweep near the sun breaks the comet into pieces, the terrific heating might turn Comet Ison into a very bright object in our sky. We'll see what happens in 2013. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. More on Comet Ison at earthsky.org. Search for the words Comet in 2013. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I give my head to the new constitution. Think a file for the new revolution. Smiling green and the jeans all around. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like yesterday. Then I'll get on my knees.
To the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can give me a call, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425, or email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. William sent me this email asking if I had seen the Foundations of Freedom show put on by Glenn Beck with this quote-unquote historian named David Barton. You may remember Barton. His book on, it was called Jefferson's Lies. I was pulled by his publisher because, well, you know, it was BS. it grossly misrepresented the former president, yanked off the shelves. And it has to be bad if a publisher who spent all the money, you know, printing it up and doing the promotion and doing it, pulls it off the shelves. You know it's bad. So where is it? Of course, goes to the extreme, goes to Beck. Do this show where evidently, according to Barton, who, as I'm told, and you know, look at this book, how's the best way of putting it? A little liberal with reality, a little, you know, takes a few, opportunities to make things up. How's that? Is that better? He was asked by Beck, and, you know, they went into this whole thing. I guess Barton's point is that he believed in the 1800s every household had a gun. And that some areas of the U.S. required every household to have a gun. And, you know, I remember, you know, going back to Washington, there was a law in the 1780s that said every male between 18 and 44 had to have a gun and, you know, a military pack and flints and balls and gunpowder. And it was really very specific on the shopping list of things that every adult male in the country must own. It's very specific, which to me, and again, we can have this whole argument about the Second Amendment. I know it's been decided, we've moved on from the reality that it was a military-based amendment. It was every male's in the militia, and government has the right to regulate the militia, which meant discipline the military, because our founders were anti-standing army. But, you know, that's kind of down the road for thoughts. But this guy's saying every household had one. And, you know, actually went into a story in the 1850s. And what the quote that William sent me is, Barton said, the great example, this Mr. Barton said, the great example in the 1950s, you have a school teacher who's teaching. A guy, he's out in the West. This guy from New England wants to kill him and finds him. So he comes into the school with his gun to shoot the teacher. And he decides not to shoot the teacher because all of the kids pull their guns out and point at him and say, "You kill our teacher, you die." Barton goes on to say, okay, the teacher lives, real simple stuff. Barton then went on to said, there are no shootings because all the kids were talking in elementary school. All the kids put their guns out and says, "We like our teacher. You shoot our teacher, we kill you." And Beck chimes in, "Well, kids didn't shoot each other, right?" And Barton says, no. There were two accidents I've seen in 200 years of everyone having guns. He said, it just didn't happen. No, just didn't happen. And you go, I would love to see this. Because, you know, he's a little loose with the facts in his book. How loose with the facts is he here? And is he advocating today that every kindergarten student go to school packing heat? And if you're the teacher, are you feeling comfortable with that? Because, again, I go back to my childhood. If I had a gun at 9, 10 years old, this planet would be minus a bunch of people. Because I used to get beat up every day. And I guarantee you, I probably would have shot a couple of them. So when I hear this, I go, you know, is this the world that they're advocating for? And I sure hope not. But here again, you know, it's all about the meme. It's all about the message. Oh, you know, back in the old days, everybody had a gun. And, you know, and folks, older folks that I've talked to, you know, and my grandfather, I don't remember him talking about everybody having a gun. I remember him talking about a lot of fistfights. I remember him talking about, you know, guys getting into dust-ups that I have to imagine, if they had guns, would end up like today, where a kid gets into a little fisticuffs or whatever happens, goes home, gets something out of grandpa's arsenal and shoots people up. So I'm just not buying that. Were there people who were responsible gun owners and taught their kids, you don't touch that, it's your behind? Yeah, I believe that. But I got to tell you, this all of this stuff we're being fed, and look, it's Glenn Beck. It is what it is. But like I said earlier, when we're talking to Brian Multi from the Brady campaign, all we're hearing are these radical voices. Every school kid had a gun. And I look at today's press conference and some of the things that came out of it, you know, I think are smart. Universal background checks. We should be doing a criminal history on people. What I find interesting is, you know, and maybe I'm wrong on this, but I find it really interesting that you have the Republicans here in the state of Pennsylvania who wanted to take your vote away, made you come in and prove you're a U.S. citizen, prove, so that you could participate in your constitutional right to the franchise, to cast a ballot. But you shouldn't have to prove that you're a citizen or anybody to buy a gun. 40% of the guns change hands with nothing. When I transfer my car, I've got to have it notarized, got to go through a whole process. And I would argue that I think cars are just as dangerous, if not more, kill more people a year than guns do. But here's the thing. Will Congress do anything? Because he wants Congress to work on this. He wants Congress to close the gun hole loophole. They're going to do the gun show loophole. Is he going to do that? No. The assault weapons ban, is that going to happen? I don't see it happening in this Congress. We should be reinstating the 94 assault weapons ban. Pretty simple. Not going to happen. We should be, as part of the assault weapons ban, high-capacity magazines was banned. We should return to that. The armor-piercing bullets, why do we need to have, I guess you could argue, because I hear a lot about the woman in Georgia. Maybe she needed to have armor-piercing bullets. I'm not seeing the need for it so much. In fact, I had one of my gun friends tell me that there's a bullet out there that doesn't go through walls. Tears flesh up, does a pretty good job on people, but doesn't go room to room. And then he talked about some common sense things that the president did, funding policemen. Not a bad idea. In fact, they're talking about $4 billion to fund police officers around the country. Seems smart to me. You want to track where guns are going. We should be having agencies talking to each other. That stuff that seems pretty simple. The academic stuff. We should be looking to research. You know, I saw a program, they were talking about that they can predict where gun violence is going to happen because they've done these studies and they can. So if you can predict it, just a thought. Just a thought. Safe gun ownership program seems reasonable. Fund school counseling, you know, some smart things there. Anti-bullying stuff, because like I said, you know, when I was a kid, if I had I knew somebody with an arsenal, probably would have found one. Just some common sense stuff in my view. Nothing radical today. Didn't do what the right wing was saying he was going to do, and I guess they made a boatload of money off of it. Not a lot of in the executive order way. Just is what it is. Let's take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
AFSCME Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? AFSCME Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of the Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
Sanity for a change. The Rick Smith Show.
Heaven knocking on the door, there's holds the throne. Heaven looking for the map that leads me home. Heaven somewhere on good hearts turning to stone. The road of good intentions is gonna dry as a bone. We take care of our own.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of our program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Remember last year, the voter suppression law that the Republicans rammed through? And I bring that up for a couple of reasons. One, you know, the whole universal background check thing to me just seems rational. Look, I mean, if you want to own this dangerous weapon, you're a law-abiding citizen. As a member of society, look, I usually take the libertarian view on many things. But this is one of those things. You're talking about a very potentially a dangerous weapon. I know guns don't kill people. People do. And you could go down that slope, but guns do kill a lot of folks. I bring it up because the very same people who are saying we shouldn't have these background checks, we shouldn't have any of these restrictions, are the very same people who are saying all those people, all those voters need to have very, very specific ID. All of those voters must follow very specific criteria. To get your right to vote, you've got to follow this. And I find this story out from the Associated Press out in Pittsburgh fairly interesting. Someone had registered as Barack H. Obama. You know, some college kid, it was a prank, and they're looking to try and find him because this is, well, this is voter fraud. This is what they're trying to tell us. This is what this article goes into. Because some kid, you know, wrote it, said, oh, I'm going to be Barack Obama, ha, 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 and turned in a registration. And they're actually looking for this person. And the article at the beginning has got this tone of, oh, there's real huge problems because, you know, there's a lot of folks, that, you know, are with these fictional names and, you know, whether it's, you know, it's Mitt Romney or Snoop Dogg or Mario Lemieux or Julius Caesar, you know, we have to go after them, according to the jury commissioner. Because evidently they were going through trying to call people for jury duty, because here in Pennsylvania, registered voters are one of the ways they look for jury duty. And they came across, you know, Barack Obama. And now they're looking because, hey, they claim it's a felony. And they make it sound like, well, there's a real problem here. And understand the voter suppression law that they passed last year and that ultimately got shot down in court because it was what it was. It was a way to keep poor voters. It was a way to keep minority voters. It was a way to keep elderly voters away from the polls. and it was the 2012 version of election theft that, you know, we're going to see in 2016 when they reallocate the electors. This, what they're making a pretty big deal of this, because they're going to try and hunt this kid down. This would not have been stopped by the voter suppression law that the Republicans passed last year. And I find that interesting, because it was all about protecting the ballot box. And you go, well, why, Rick? Why is that not something that would have been covered? Well, be honest, nobody tried to go vote as Barack Obama. But anytime this stuff comes up, you go, well, you know, we need to have voter ID. Well, this wasn't it. And I'm frustrated by not only that debate, but this one on the gun issue. Because it's the very same people who, you know, they were hell-bent on everybody's got to have an ID, everyone's got to have a card, everyone's got to have... And now, just the opposite. I find that interesting. And the debate that we're hearing, I'm sorry, the voices that I'm hearing, and I'm hoping Brian Multy's right. I'm hoping that more rational voices are going to rise as this goes on. But all I'm hearing are the radicals. And you know, is Alex Jones the new face of the gun movement? I sure hope so. That ad that the NRA put out, is that the new face of the NRA? I sure hope so. Because it exposes what they are, radicals. Nobody wants to take people's guns away. I don't. I don't want to take law-abiding citizens' guns away. I don't want to leave people unprotected, because I know some people, I've got friends who, they don't leave the house. They feel naked without their gun, and they are good for them. Nobody's talking about taking those. But here again, I don't think we need assault weapons. I don't think we need 100 bullet magazines. It's one of those things. And behind all of this, I take it back to the money. Look at how much money the gun industry has made since Obama has come into office. And up until now, I don't think Obama's mentioned the word guns. Up until this latest tragedy, there has been no serious legislation. There's been no serious push. But boy, since the day Obama took office, I have been hearing from my gun friends, he's taking them. He's doing this. Bullets are going to go. I remember the email I got. Bullets are going to go up 500%. And, you know, someone stole that from Chris Rock. Who did a bid on it about, well, we should make bullets $5,000 so that if you kill somebody, it's somebody you really wanted to kill, because you were going to have to pay a lot of money for it. And the reason the price of bullets went up is because so many of the paranoid ran out and bought them, supply and demand. So when we step back and we lower our voices, we open our ears, all of what we're being fed doesn't seem so smart. All of the radical, out of my cold, dead hands, doesn't seem so rational. Because like I said, I don't ever want any parent to have that phone call, ever have a state trooper show up on their door. Definitely don't want it. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, hour three of the program. Stick around.
Your
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. As auto companies in Detroit show off their shiny new autos of the future, auto workers were there to showcase the struggles of workers looking for brighter futures. Jesse Russell reports.
The Detroit Auto Show not only showed off the future of the auto industry, it also showcased the struggles of working people. A series of protests were held outside of the event throughout the weekend, highlighting everything from pushing back against Michigan's right-to-work law to unionizing Nissan plants in Mississippi. One woman at the anti-right-to-work rally this weekend said people need to stand up to corporate control.
The first thing is we have to overcome the fear that people have and the media message and the corporate message that we should all be glad we have a job and it doesn't matter what kind of conditions those jobs are.
One auto worker named Martin said one of the most important things labor could be doing right now is educating the next generation of workers.
If we can continue to educate and try to mobilize just not inside the plant but also outside the plant, that people know what's going on, then I think we have to be heading in the right direction.
A Korean labor union unhappy with a Hyundai Motors subcontractor has posted a petition on the White House We the People website. It calls on the Obama administration to pressure Hyundai to rehire temporary workers who were laid off. In Chicago, labor activists who support single-payer universal health care held their 2013 conference this week. Chicago Teachers Union President Karen Lewis delivered the keynote speech. Lewis said the 2012 Chicago teachers' strike demonstrates the power of community solidarity as firefighters welcomed striking teachers into their homes for meals, and parents also supported them. She says labor must attract and energize young people if it is to have a future. Lewis says as workers everywhere face another year of struggles, community coalitions and solidarity is crucial, and workers need to take the fight to the streets of communities nationwide.
We need to continue to build coalitions. Labor alone cannot win this fight. If we don't have community with us, we will be irrelevant quickly. If we don't continue to energize our ranks, to me, the beauty of our strike was that there were so many people without a single strand of gray hair. Regardless of where you are, you still have more to do, as do we all. It can't be a bunch of phone calls, brothers and sisters, face to face, one at a time, person to person. Stop preaching to the choir, take off those robes, and get in the streets.
This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers and from OPEIU.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So it looks like the FAA is grounding the Boeing 787, the big Dreamliners. They claim a possible risk of battery fires and something that's got to be addressed. So I looked at this, and I know that the Boeing and their engineers have been in contract negotiations for the better part of a year, probably more than a year now. And I guess where does this leave the contract negotiations? Where does this leave the company? This is kind of a problem, which is why we've asked Ray Goforth to come and talk to us. He's executive director of SPEA, the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace, to come talk to us about the situation. Ray, thanks for taking time for me.
Thanks for having me.
So I guess the first question is, where are you guys with your contract negotiations now? It's been, over a year now, right?
Yeah, we've been negotiating for over a year. Our members voted down the company's last offer on October 1st. 96% of our members voted to reject the company offer. We went back to the table the very next day. Didn't receive another offer from the company until this Monday. It was still across the board cuts. So today, what SPEA did is we made a proposal to the company, that we take the elements that we have been able to agree on, and we just plop those into the existing collective bargaining agreement and move forward so that everyone can focus on restoring public confidence in the 787.
Now, does this now mean the contract is settled, or will you continue to negotiate on the things you don't agree on?
No, we made a proposal. I mean, what's been going on is the company has been seeking to eliminate our pension, vastly increase our medical costs, and cut our salary growth 40%, and cut the training program. So the union's proposal would leave all of those economic items as they are now. Then there's some other areas where the union and the employer have been able to agree, and we would just fold those into the existing collective bargaining agreement, change the dates on it so it'll stay in place for another 4 years. That's the union's proposal. The company did not respond.
Okay, and where do you see this going? I mean, because now you're talking about the health care, the pensions, the wage. That obviously probably not in your proposal, right?
No, all those would be in our proposal. So we would continue to get wage increases. Our healthcare costs would stay the same, and our members would keep the pension.
Okay. Well, and where do you see that going?
If the company agrees, then we're done. We bring these negotiations to a conclusion. Everyone can focus on building and fixing airplanes. If the company rejects this, then the likelihood of a strike is very high.
And that would be a horrible outcome for not only the workers but for the company, because look, I'm seeing these reports almost every day now, another one of these Dreamliners being grounded for one thing or another.
Yeah, a couple hours ago, the FAA actually ordered every Dreamliner to be grounded until they can figure out what the problems are. So this is a terrible time for the company, but we've been preparing seriously for a strike for about 2 months because of the company's intransigence in these negotiations. This would really be just a wise move for the company to back off on their effort to impose these cuts and let everyone focus on the business of the Boeing Company.
Because it would seem very short-sighted of me from their perspective to have you guys go on strike, since you're going to be the ones figuring this stuff out, right?
Exactly. Although the chief engineer for Boeing Commercial was asked that question by a reporter last Friday, and his answer was that he didn't need our engineers and techs to do this work, that managers could do it. Which everyone from industry analysts to our members have reacted to with the scorn to laughter.
Well, I mean, I guess the question then becomes, is that the view of the company? And that's probably why you're getting the problem that you have, that, well, you're disposable.
And that's exactly been the attitude we've been experiencing at the bargaining table. And it's, we hoped that after our members rejected the company's contract offer that they would get more realistic. But they haven't. We spent the last 3.5 months with the company just going back and forth about different types of cuts. And most people may not know this, but the Boeing Company is fabulously profitable. They're literally posting record profits. They just gave all their executives double-digit salaries.
Of course they did.
Yeah. So, but for the engineers and techs that are generating all this wealth, it's across-the-board pay and benefit cuts.
Well, Ray, how do you think they're paying for those lavish salaries for the folks in the gilded offices?
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it's just not you. It's employees and workers across this country who have seen the exact same thing, whether you're working at Walmart or you're working at Caterpillar or you're working, at Joe's down the street.
Yeah, this is a story that we've seen all across this country.
So, the question then becomes is this position that they've taken? Because, I was thinking about this earlier. I mean, is it a position to push you out on strike, give you nothing, and force you into that so that they can look elsewhere, India, who knows where, to outsource the job that you do?
Well, the reasons that they're having the problems with these 787s is because they outsourced so much of the work on them. This was the first time Boeing built a new airplane where they outsourced huge sections of the work, and now we're looking at the results of that with an airplane that's experiencing problems, and the FAA has grounded the entire fleet.
So where was this work done?
Well, it's going to depend upon what the problems were, but the most obvious problems they've been talking about have been these batteries, and the batteries were made in Japan, and so whether it's the batteries themselves or the electrical components they're hooked to, I don't think they've determined yet.
And how many instances have they had of this? Because I've seen a couple of reports, and I got to be honest, I haven't been following it, but I've seen a couple of reports, and it's been enough to make me go, well, wait a minute, those are the big ones, those are the new ones. You don't want to screw this line up because you might lose the next generation of planes to somebody else.
Yeah, well, just in the last week and a half, there at Logan Airport, there was a 787 that caught on fire while it was on the tarmac. And they determined it was something to do with the battery. Then there were two fuel leaks, a brake fluid leak, another airplane that had to land because of what they think was a battery issue. And then just today, a plane, a 787 in Japan, had to make an emergency landing because the cockpit filled with smoke. And they think they've traced that down to a different battery issue.
Yeah, definitely not something I want my pilot being passed out from smoke inhalation. But yeah, how much of this is, you know, this is a new airliner, this is a new design, new model, all of that. How much is it just, you know, the working out the kinks?
Well, you know, the kinks are supposed to get worked out before the airlines go into service. But our members still have supreme confidence that this airplane has a number of cutting-edge innovations. So you might expect it to have some greater difficulty, more kinks to work out than a number plane. Our members, retain confidence that once this stuff is hired out, that everyone's going to want to fly on this airplane.
And it would be nice. You know, I'm looking back to this contract fight. It would be nice to put that behind you, to heal this and come back together and work to solve those problems.
And that was what underlaid the union's proposals today. It was just, you know, we've been at this for more than a year. We're headed towards a strike, so let's just, you know, pause right here, roll over the existing benefits where the company's been trying to cut them, and move forward, and everyone can focus on getting this plane recertified and back into the air.
I got to tell you though, Ray, from a perspective of, and this is just my perspective, and I'm sure it's not yours, that, you know, right now you've got them, you know, kind of where you want them. I mean, they're having problems. They do need you no matter what they say publicly. They do need your guys. This is a bargaining chip in my mind.
It would be fair to interpret things that way. But our members are, they're problem solvers by nature. They want what they think is fair and justified, and they don't necessarily want more than that. And our members have been telling us since we began these negotiations that they would be fine just extending their existing collective bargaining agreement. So what we propose today is a version of that, although it does have a number of sort of minor improvements that we have been able to agree to over the course of these negotiations.
And when
question will be how Boeing reacts.
And when do you expect to get a response?
We're supposed to meet again tomorrow at 9 a.m. But if the company rejects our proposal, then this is going to be a very negative future indeed. We've been counting down towards a strike that we would expect to start in a matter of weeks.
Yeah, I got to be honest. I've been on strike a couple of times, and it's not something that I would say you rush into. And I know over a year of negotiating, I know you haven't rushed into the thoughts of it either.
Yeah, and that's, you know, we've been taking this very seriously, and we're negotiating for 23,000 people. So we know if we do go out on strike, there are going to be a number of just tragedies, just people experiencing great hardship, and this is something that we would like to avoid. But on the other hand, our members are generating vast amounts of wealth for the Boeing Company, and the company's approach to these negotiations demanding cuts to pay, cuts to benefit, elimination of the pension are so provocative that we've been prepared to go on strike if that's what is necessary.
I mean, to me, it's just a basic The basic concept of fairness. I mean, you, what I talk about all the time. Not wanting it all, but a fair share of the wealth that, that people create, we should be giving, we should be getting. It's that simple to me.
And then, and that's the perspective our members have.
Whether you're an engineer at Boeing or you're the fry cook at McDonald's or you're working at the Walmart or wherever, the creation of all these billions and tens of billions of dollars, you know, that's how we had the most prosperous, the largest middle class in the history of civilization, by those working people having a little bit of that.
Exactly.
So I wish you nothing but the best as this goes on. I would love to hear back tomorrow where you guys end up, and we'll be here when this is settled one way or the other.
Well, thanks for having me, and always happy to come back.
Ray, it's always great talking with you. Ray Gofforth, SPEA Executive Director of the Society of Professional Engineering Employees in Aerospace. Quick break, right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Look out! The fixers are coming. Top corporate chieftains and Wall Street gamblers want to tell Washington how to fix our national debt, so they've created a front group called Fix the Debt to push their agenda. Unfortunately, they're using fix in the same way your veterinarian uses it. Their core demand is for Washington to spay Social Security, castrate Medicare, and geld Medicaid. Of course, a group of pampered, narcissistic billionaires would not make a credible sales team for this dirty work. So Fix the Debt has recruited a bipartisan gaggle of former Congress critters to give their self-serving political gambit a softer public image, a sheen of high public purpose. With a budget of some $40 million, these elder statesmen are doing TV interviews, hosting breakfast sessions with members of Congress, making speeches about mutual sacrifice, and generally going all out to sell the financial elites snake oil. But wait, being an elder does not automatically mean you're a statesman. Let's peek at the resumes of these so-called public-spirited fixers of the debt. Start with Jim McCreary, a former GOP lawmaker. While urging Congress to cut people's programs, he's also a top-paid lobbyist pushing Congress to give more tax subsidies to America's richest people and biggest multinational corporations. Former Democratic Senator Sam Nunn is a fixer, too, but he's also paid $300,000 a year to be a board director for General Electric. Likewise, Democrat Erskine Bowles, a co-founder of the Fixers Front Group, is on the board of Morgan Stanley, drawing $345,000 a year. And former GOP Senator Judd Gregg takes about $1 million a year as advisor to and board member of such giants as Goldman Sachs and Honeywell. This is Jim Hightower saying, I wouldn't want this gang of fixers to pet my dog, much less touch my Social Security.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing in Washington State, but we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina. Because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
Yeah!
Smith Show. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website, thericksmithshow.com, or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Email me, Rick, at thericksmithshow.com. So, I look at this, and, while we're talking about the guns thing, we're talking about the lottery, we're talking a lot of diversion, a lot of things. The House of Representatives, nothing on the debt ceiling. A new report out by the World Bank, though, and this is something I find very serious. Their report is saying, look, and we all know this, that if the U.S. screws this up, if the U.S. is seen as weak, if they've seen as they're not paying their bills, could screw up across the globe. This idea that you're gonna monkey around with the debt ceiling, just dumb. And in the statement, they write it could cause fiscal paralysis, and that would cause the U.S. economy to shrink, knocking Europe into a deeper contraction, and reducing global growth by 1.4%. So all of this stuff, this inward, this austerity, this inability to do what was just, a couple of years ago was standard procedure. Pay your bills. And there are a number of Democrats, six of them. Jerry Nadler, Hank Johnson from Georgia, Moran from Virginia, Schakowsky, who we've had on the program a number of times, from Illinois, Ellison and Peter Welch, who've said, you know what? Do away with it. We need to abolish the debt limit. Get rid of it. Because it's not doing anyone any good. All it's doing is giving Republicans another one of these moments to hold this nation hostage. And as they point out, ABC pointed out that the Danish Congress has set the ceiling high enough, their debt ceiling high enough, that it never slows the process of borrowing money, and they can avoid political conflicts. And you go, they're the only other nation in the world that has one of these debt ceilings. Now, what happens? Let's say we don't raise the debt ceiling, and they shut the government down. Think about the things that we. And look, there are Republicans who want this. They want part two. They want the next. They want the rematch. They got their hats handed to them in the 90s. They want the rematch. They've been chomping for this for years. But understand what the consequences are. We are not out of the woods yet. We are still suffering from the Bush recession, which if it weren't for unemployment, if it weren't for food stamps, if it weren't for government programs, we would have been in a full depression. If it weren't for the elastic programs that kept this economy semi-moving along, we would have completely collapsed, and you know that. But Fitch Ratings said on Tuesday that failure to raise that debt ceiling, failure to do it in a quote-unquote timely manner, you know what's coming? A downgrade. Our AAA rating is going to be downgraded. Even if the Treasury Department makes all of their payments, their debt payments are made, it's still going to bring it down because there's this. The Republicans love talking about uncertainty, the uncertainty. Fitch points out that they're concerned about a longer-term agreement. They said in the absence of a good medium-term deficit deal, the negative outlook on the AAA rating is likely to be resolved with a downgrade later this year, even if another debt ceiling crisis is averted. They say the debt ceiling is an ineffective and potentially dangerous mechanism for enforcing fiscal discipline. And this is where my mindset on this is. This is what they said. It does not prevent tax and spending decisions that will incur debt issuance in excess of the ceiling, while the sanctions of not raising the ceiling risks a sovereign default and renders such a threat incredible. And I've been saying for a while, look, you know, we just had this whole conversation about funding the victims of Hurricane Sandy. The Republicans held this off for far too long. That should have been something dealt with in the 112th Congress. It was recently done, dealt with in the 113th. It's headed over to the Senate as we speak. Understand, the exact same amount. The exact same amount that they could have done a month ago or more. The exact same amount. But they went and they said, okay, we're going to allocate, well, I think it was, what, $60.4 billion? And this is what Fitch is saying. Look, it has done nothing to stop their spending. The debt ceiling was supposed to, well, re-examine it. No. It's not that at all. When you examine spending is before you spend it. Just a thought. Fitch also points out, recent history suggests these short-term fixes will be agreed, albeit only just before each deadline is breached, that do little more than postpone key decisions and perpetuate the uncertainty over tax and spending policies and fail to place the U.S. public finances on a medium-term sustainable path. Our politicians aren't doing their jobs. And I look at this whole debt debacle. There are things we should be looking at. A lot of things. But we should be looking at the revenue side as well. And the big deal, to me, was a big ripoff. It was a bad deal. And I understand, look, you know, the president and Democrats were in a tough spot. Because Democrats will not. I truly believe they don't have it in them. They don't have scorched earth in them. I know Republicans do. I know they're willing to. I've seen two-year-olds. And I compare them to the party of two-year-olds right now. The extremists in their party. And I'm hoping there are some rational ones left. And I've had a lot of Democratic representatives tell me over the past several months, well, you know, there are some good Republicans left. And I keep saying, show me. I want to see it. You know, Stephen LaTourette, the guy from Ohio, he left. He was fairly moderate. Used to be considered a liberal Republican. Then moderate. And I look at how far the goalposts keep going to the extreme right. And Democrats keep marching along with them. So the whole political paradigm shifting to the right. Instead of talking about the things that we really need to be talking about, investing in infrastructure, investing in jobs programs, pursuing full employment, the things my grandfather's generation, my grandparents' generations fought for, because those were important, making sure everyone had the ability to get a job. I mean, now we've got Walmart saying, well, you know, those guys coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan, we'll put them to work. Yeah, but at what kind of wage? Minimum wage? How many of those guys? And it's nice that, well, we're going to hire veterans and pay them basically minimum wage. And the shoe that I'm waiting to drop, and I'm hoping some reporter looks into it, is what subsidies are they getting for this? Because I'm cynical. I'm a bit jaded on this because I've seen what Walmart has done. I've seen what these big corporations, these huge conglomerates, I've seen what they've done. Look, I'm not anti-corporations. Some good ones, and I have people tell me all the time, Rick, there's some good companies out there. I'm sure there are. But at the end of the day, you can only be as good as the worst one. Because, and I think Josh Idelson pointed it out earlier, you know, they're the standard bearer. They're either the one raising conditions or pulling them down. Their supply chain is either raising conditions of workers or pulling them down. And one, you know, I've had people say, well, one's no better than the other, and it's true. Which is why you need to be. We need to be pushing industry-wide. Yeah, I had an interesting conversation, and it just popped into my head. I was out doing a sales call here recently, and you have to go through security at this building and go through the whole signing away. This is who I am, and check your driver's license and all of that stuff. And as I'm talking to the guy, we're having the security guard having this conversation, and we happen to be talking just about Walmart and the crummy wages. And he goes, yeah, this job doesn't pay all that great either. And I said, what has to happen is security guards, security officers like you in this area have to do what they did in Philadelphia, where they have, as a city, industry-wide, they have tried to organize all of those people so that, you know what, it doesn't matter which company you work for, they're basically all paying about the same. The floor is being raised under everyone's feet. That's what has to happen. It has to happen in every one of these low-paying jobs. And I told him, I worked as a security guard when I was in college and just after. And I remember, look, minimum wage. You're protecting millions of dollars worth of assets. You're protecting, these huge multinational mega corporations, minimum wage, no benefits. And I remember telling him, I worked as a security guard. One of the last security jobs I had was at a state office building. Where, 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm supposed to be going down in downtown Cleveland on, underneath the building in the parking area where only the homeless people are living, and there they are having their fights and doing all that stuff, to check out a couple of cars with nothing but a flashlight for minimum wage? You go, really? And again, it's about having that. And I remember people that, I remember guys who had been doing those jobs for years and really very dedicated, decent, wonderful people who took great pride in those jobs. Having to go to food banks, having to rely on food stamps, having to rely on heating assistance, having to rely on Medicaid, having to rely on handouts while going, putting 40 hours in a week protecting multi-million dollar assets. And I got to tell you, there's something seriously wrong with that. Which is why I am such a firm believer in people organizing and collective bargaining. And And I think that's why you see the right wing in this country and the wealth class in this country doing so much to tear it down, to destroy it. Every time you turn around, there's an attack. Oh, it's the unions. It's this evil entity that they've created. You know who the unions are? The unions are people like you and me. It's those security guards in Philadelphia now who are protecting the inner city at night. It's those state workers who have made Pennsylvania's lottery one of the best in the country. An example that the company that wants to take it over has used as an example in other states. So the attacks are BS. Are there some things that go wrong? You bet. In anything, you're going to have something go wrong. But the reality is, in all my 20 years as a card-carrying member of the Teamsters Union, I did well. My coworkers did well. We were able to support our families and be part of that middle class. But as you destroy that ability, as you destroy that component of making it to the middle class, you push us all down, and we end up in this desperation class. Let's take a quick break. Right back with Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
We gotta get organized. We gotta do it today. No more madness to do. No more disarray.
listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get The Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Are you feeling that back-to-school squeeze? Backpacks, clothes, shoes, all the things they have to have because last year's stuff is so last year? If you have a supply shortage, we can help. We know what it's like, and we've got the ultimate hall pass for you. Transfer your high-interest and department store balances to PSECU. Our Visa balance transfer has a low 2.9 annual percentage rate. Good through New Year's Eve of 2013. We don't charge you a transfer fee, and you can roll up to $20,000 in balances if you qualify. That's a lot of swag. Financing life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or visit pfecu.com/visa for complete program details.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration, Equal Opportunity Lender.
Ganley Law is a proud sponsor of The Rick Smith Show. To better serve you, Ganley Law has 9 offices throughout Pennsylvania. Call our main office in Waynesboro. If we think we can help you, we'll schedule a time and place that is convenient for you for a confidential initial consultation at no charge. At Ganley Law, you pay no retainer and no attorney fees unless we are successful in bringing your claim. Our experienced attorneys, Charles Ganley and Deborah Packer, will fight for your rights. If you face a work-related injury, an occupational disease such as hearing loss, work-related hepatitis, or HIV, sexual harassment, or employment discrimination, call Ganley Law. That's toll-free statewide at 1-888-FIGHT-17. That's 1-888-334-4817. Ganley Law, fighting for workers' rights, fighting for your rights.
Also at GanleyLaw.com.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
The most important issues of the day. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. So guns, the topic of the day. Seems like everybody's talking about the guns. They're coming for the guns. A couple of friends of mine, you know, going out and buying a whole bunch now. I'm like, why? Why waste the money? You've got an arsenal. What do you need more for? But this whole conversation, I guess something we have to go through, which is why I've got Talk Radio News Service, Bob Ney from Talk Radio News Service, to tell us what's going on in D.C. after the big press conference. Bob, thanks for taking time for me.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So what are your thoughts on the big press conference? Anything surprising, anything shocking, anything that you goes, wow, that's never going to happen?
I think a couple things surprised me. One, the president didn't go into the use of executive orders as everybody basically thought maybe he would, that he would, you know, do executive orders on all 19 of the formats that he talked about. So he didn't do that. And that kind of surprised me. The issue that two issues he got into, one was the private sale. If I sell you a gun, I can go through a gun dealer. This is what he'd like Congress to do. Go through a gun dealer, do a background check on you, because 40% of the guns are just shifting in and out of private hands.
Right.
He would exempt family sale to family. And then, you know, he's, for the first time, has broached an issue using the words mental illness. And when I say broached an issue before, that just simply was, nope, not going to happen, nothing to do with it.
Well, because I've seen a number of stories today on, you know, you've got a bunch of psychologists and psychiatrists saying, whoa, we don't want to be talking about that because, well, we're going to somehow further stigmatize them or make them not seek treatment?
Well, I think there's going to be some kind of carve-out is what they're probably going to look at, some type of carve-out that, you know, if you think that, in fact, in some states this can be done, some it can't, but if you think that, you know, somebody is going to walk into a school and go crazy or into a restaurant or whatever, then, you know, you have some ability to act. Now, the other topics they're going to talk about, how you find out about a person's treatment of mental illness, and that's in a background check. That's a whole different legal quagmire. But the Republican, I was very watchful of the Republican, you know, ideas that they came forth. Some of the people just said, nope, Second Amendment. But Goodlatte, who has a committee of jurisdiction in the House, a Republican from Virginia, his statements I watched with interest where he said, you know, well, we need to have a discussion. But he also said, we will also look at another proposal. That's not your normal no.
Right.
The automatic weapon ban, military-style assault, whatever you want to call it, I fully expected the president to do that.
Yeah, so, I mean, to me, letting it expire and not re-upping it, to me, seemed like a dumb idea to begin with. But, a lot of this gun stuff seems to me we could come to an agreement on pretty easily.
I was out there when it expired. And, you know, when it came into being, a Republican, actually, who's now our governor, was one of the, John Kasich was a key vote to put it into being. So it's happened once before. That means it could happen again.
Yeah, you know, and talking about Goodlatte, you know, he was asked, I think he was at, what was it, he was on Washington Journal on C-SPAN, and he was asked about why they didn't allow weapons at the RNC, at the Republican National Convention. And he claimed, well, the Secret Service didn't allow him because you got presidential candidates there. And, you know, you don't want a bunch of people walking around with guns while the presidential candidates. And I'm going, well, you want them walking around with my kid? And, you know, and look at that NRA ad. I got to be honest with you. What's going on with these people over at the NRA? Have they completely lost their mind?
There's two issues that are going to be raised that both involve children, the president having children at the press conference and the NRA ad talking about the president's children. And I think, you know, you can make an argument on either one. I think that the mentioning the children in the ad was gave me chills. I mean, just let the kids be out of it.
Yeah,
the president's children shouldn't be an issue. Now, if they want to say the president has a bodyguard, the president has guns around him.
Absolutely.
It's fair game. But the kids, just, you know, come on.
But even still, I mean, you know, to bring them into it, look, I mean, that's a completely different ballgame. When you run for that office or you're in that office, you are an absolute target from every, you know, no matter, from every insane segment that you can find.
And some schools, look, my children went to public school and there was an armed officer there because they had an officer, you know, basically a service officer, whatever they call it. That was years ago in a small town because they chose to do it. Some schools can do it. The question is, do you mandate a school to do it? And I don't think you mandate a school to do that. Those are local school board decisions they'll eventually make.
Yeah, and personally, I got to be honest with you. I don't know that I want policemen in every hallway and in every classroom. I don't want my school to look like a police state.
And you know, the locals will decide, again, those issues. And the president's not saying he's going to mandate. Now, he did talk a lot about school resources.
Right.
Getting also policemen on the street. So that education component, I think that's going to be looked at. He's going to allow the CDC to do some things. And some of it I didn't understand, even as a former member, why some of the research was frozen. What on earth was that about?
Yeah, but again, you know, I look at this, and to be honest, over the last decade, this idea of funding research by the federal government has been something that you know, your former party, you know, they've turned their back on. And then you look at the stuff with the Hurricane Sandy stuff. They balked at funding research on, you know, what's going to happen to those areas. What kind of levees do we need? What kind of storm preparation studies do we need? Balked at that.
I don't know where this research was frozen at. That one, I kind of racked my brain to try to remember that one.
It's just, to me, and there's got to be, do you see any movement in the Republican part in the ranks to say, okay, well, we got to do some common sense thing? Because to me, the assault weapons ban should have been right there at the top. And I got to be honest with you, the hollow point bullets and the armor piercing bullets, I don't know why you need those.
Well, I think that the assault weapon, you know, had some votes previous, and again, that issue can come back up. And And some of the gun advocates will say we don't need that type of weapon.
I'm with you. What do you think of the statement that, you know, Reagan was, I forget who it was, something along the lines of that Reagan, you know, at the end of his life, yeah, he supported gun control at the end of his life, but not all the way up, all the way through his life. I'm going, but didn't he sign some waiting period while he was governor of California? That seems to pop into my mind.
Yeah, I don't know about that, but he, you know, he had written that famous letter to the congressman in Washington and changed his mind on the assault ban. You know, he wrote that letter personally. But it seems to me that he was involved somewhere as governor with that issue, as he was with some prevailing wage union issues.
Yeah.
On their side.
Yeah, it's interesting how they're rewriting it. And this guy, this Pratt guy, is the guy who said it. He was being interviewed by Andrea Mitchell, and basically saying that he's senile. Well, that was later in his years. You know, we have to keep that in account, he said. But you got to remember, later in his life, he was also shot by somebody too.
Now, gun owners of America tend to be even more hard-lined than the NRA. Way more hard-lined. That's Larry Pratt's group.
Eric Pratt, I guess his name is, actually.
Yeah, that's his group. They tend to be really, really hard-lined, believe it or not, more than the NRA.
Yeah. Well, it'll be interesting to see where this goes from this point forward. What are you hearing on the debt ceiling? I see Fitch came out with a report saying, I guess it was Tuesday, saying that they see a downgrade in our future.
I think the Republicans made a huge error. If you wanted to take a stand and draw a line in the sand, the fiscal cliff was the stand to do, because you could draw the line, let it expire. Within 60 days, you could try to, you know, correct it. This one, they can't let this one go. Fitch is going to downgrade us.
Yeah. As happened to us the last time they held the debt ceiling hostage.
That's correct.
This makes really no sense to me, and I see there are a number, I guess, six Democrats who have introduced legislation today to get rid of it.
Yes, they did. The debt ceiling used to be, you know, you voted on it, you yawned, and you went to dinner. That's the way it was when I was there not that long ago. Now it's the end-all vote, but it's paying for things that have already been dispersed, have already been appropriated.
And like I asked Ellen last night, Ellen Ratner from from Talk Radio News, you know, why did we bother going through the whole funding the victims of Hurricane Sandy if we're not going to pay bills that we've already incurred? Why bother making new ones if we're telling everybody we're not paying the old ones?
Well, because Congress likes to do one thing and then say another, and that's the way Congress functions.
Come on.
It doesn't make logical sense.
Come on, you can't be dissing your former colleagues like that.
Well, I there's a lot of good ones, but I'm going to diss a lot of them too. There's a lot of good ones still somewhere in the process.
Well, while you're on the idea of dissing them, what is going on with the Postal Service? Why can't we not get any rational? You know, they last year renamed 60 post offices, have done nothing to try and save the Postal Service, and in fact, this Inspector General is saying if nothing's done, they could be out of business by the end of the year, and I don't believe that, but they're saying, you know, the way it looks financially, they're in big trouble.
This is sort of like Amtrak. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. Then the Postal Service comes. Then the Postal Service, you know, tends to say, well, we're separate from Congress. Well, no, they aren't. Everybody ought to recognize that. They are not. They can be technically chartered separate or semi-moved separate out of the jurisdiction of Congress. We want a postal system or we don't. If we do, then Congress is going to have to get actively involved to stabilize the thing.
But, I mean, isn't... Honestly and truthfully, the fix is very, very simple. Undo the poison pill that they put in 2006.
The
75 years of funding pensions for workers that haven't even been born yet?
Oh, the upfront loading.
Yeah, I mean, they're funding pensions for workers, for postal carriers who aren't even born yet.
Sure. You know, we should be so thoughtful on Social Security, make sure it's there for 75 years, as we've tried to make them do it.
I mean, to me, that's the poison pill that was designed to kill the Postal Service. Pure and simple, that's bottom line, that's it.
And of course, there's always been talk about trying to privatize the thing, you know?
Yeah, back during the Reagan years. Reagan, they actually, I was talking to a guy the other day who was actually in the Reagan cabinet, lower down in the Reagan cabinet. He said they had done a poll. You know, they did a survey to find out, because they wanted to privatize the Postal Service, and it came back 80% of the people in this country said, leave the Postal Service the hell alone.
Well, they're smart, because they're not going to, if you're in certain areas of the country and you privatize it and you're not profitable, you are not going to get mail delivered.
And, you know, that's the other thing. I mean, What's it going to cost in rural areas like I live to get someone to deliver the mail or a package? And what's it going to mean to UPS and all the other companies that allow the Postal Service to make that last mile delivery? There's a lot to be considered here.
Absolutely.
And not to mention all of the jobs that we cannot at this point afford to lose.
And I think they're going to have to sit down and listen to the Postal Service if they want a U.S. Postal Service to people.
It's nuts. What's going on globally? I understand there's some trouble in Mali.
Mali's a hotbed, and there's a lot of lunatics over in Mali. The Al-Qaeda has moved towards that area near Africa. The French are in there full force, and the French are asking us for help. We've done some intelligence and some surveillance, frankly, over there, but they're asking for some quote, military assistance. And the White House has said that they are willing to look at that. But there is a law we passed, I can't remember exactly what year, when some people took over, the rogue group, runt group, took over Mali. And so we would have to technically do something with that in order to intervene there. But it was an announcement today they got buried because of the gun issue.
Yeah, you look at this stuff, and the gun issue has taken the air out of everything else.
Everything.
And while everything else is being ignored, like a jobs bill, like an infrastructure bill, like, you know, things that are actually going to get our economy moving so we can solve some of our financial problems and some of our other problems, that stuff gets ignored, and we focus on this stuff.
It's a crime that the infrastructure bill is in the condition it is. That's ridiculous. That's been a bill that was kumbaya and get it moving. I cannot understand the Republicans doing this with the transportation bill.
That makes no sense. Last line of questioning, a lot of changes in the Obama administration, in the cabinet. Ken Salazar stepping down today.
Yes, and it's for purely personal reasons. And it's a family reason with an autistic grandson. He has some responsibility. I like what Ken said, which was, you take care of your family first, the rest will fall in place.
Right. Well, it'll be interesting to see what happens as these confirmation hearings come up, because there have been a number of folks who've moved along.
And Schumer came on board with Hagel. That helped Hagel a lot today.
Yeah. So I'm still waiting to see who he's going to put in as labor secretary.
Yeah, that's what I want to see. That's an important position.
I'm hoping. Bob, it's always great talking with you.
Thank
I appreciate
you,
the time.
Thank you.
Bob Nay, Talk Radio News Service. Quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
What would our state look like if we all put people first?
Livable wages.
Decent place to live.
Affordable health care.
The only way we will get there is if you join us in the fight.
Put people first.
Join us at Put People First for our Getting Into Step event, celebrating Martin Luther King's life and carrying forward his legacy. It's on Wednesday, January 23rd at 6 p.m. at the Midtown Scholar Bookstore in Harrisburg. We hope to see you there.
Earth, sky.
Astronomers have discovered a new comet. It's out beyond Jupiter's orbit now, but it's heading for a close encounter with the Sun in 2013.
Its official name is C-2012 S1 Ison, but we've heard some astronomers call it just plain Comet Ison for the International Scientific Optical Network in Russia, where scientists discovered it. Its orbital characteristics indicate it might become a very bright object in Earth's sky beginning in November of 2013.
Comets have a mystique. Once considered omens of doom, they're now known as icy visitors from the outer solar system that sweep near our sun, then disappear again into the depths of space. People get excited about comets. This comet will be no exception.
In November of 2013, Comet Ison will pass less than 1.8 million kilometers, about 1.1 million miles, from the surface of the sun. That sounds like a lot, but it's actually very close. Over 100 times closer to the Sun than Earth is. Unless its close sweep near the Sun breaks the comet into pieces, the terrific heating might turn Comet Ison into a very bright object in our sky. We'll see what happens in 2013. I'm Jorge Salazar.
And I'm Deborah Bird. More on Comet Ison at earthsky.org. Search for the words Comet in 2013. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
And so tonight, to you, the great silent majority and my fellow Americans, I ask for your support.
Well, some good news out of the Treasury Department. Yeah. They're making contingency plans to make sure that they can pay their bills in the event that, well, Republicans pursue scorched earth and we don't raise the debt ceiling. And, you know what they're going to do. It's screw the workers. That's right. Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, told Congress that he's no longer able to fund the G Fund, which is the retirement plan for the federal employees. He's saying the move is one of the extraordinary measures that they need to free up funds to pay other more important things. And you know, I love how, whether it's this or the pension hearings or when you go through bankruptcy, it's all about screwing those workers, isn't it? Got an interesting story came across my desk, and I've been saying this, watch for it, it's coming. The privatization of the wine and spirit shops, front and center, going to be back. Well, the Shill Group over at the Pennsylvania Independent had a story, is prohibition finally dying in Pennsylvania? And they cited all of the same privateers, the same people who, the ones who would fit, the Tinky Tank and the Chamber of Commerce. I look at this and it just blows my mind because I truly believe that the deal's already been done. The backroom deal's been done. It couldn't pass the legislature last time. The public's not in favor of it. They're not there. I talk to people all the time and go, I just don't know that I feel comfortable giving that up. Because, again, it comes back to what I talked about at the beginning. Once you give that up, what do you end up with? And once, because there's a lot of stuff here, and I go back to the, and I think it was a great way that this professor put it. When you have very measurable things, maybe you can then consider outcourt. When things are clear-cut, concrete, you know where the specific goals are, you know what the specific outcomes are going to be, it's predictable, it's right there, then you can start looking to outsource that. But things where there's a lot of variables, there's a lot of this and that, a lot of moving parts, are very complex, don't privatize it. The wine and spirit shop's one of those. Works well. Works very well. Brings hundreds of millions of dollars into the state coffers every year. And provides a firewall for some of the it's not going to stop all of the negative things, the external risk, the bad outcomes, it's not going to stop all that, but it puts a firewall there. There's a break. Cuz I've said this before, I don't want alcohol to be the impulse item next to the Tic Tacs like it was when I was a kid. And I was talking to one of a mother of one of the girls on the basketball team I coached. And when I was 15, I was walking into the the local store and buying whatever I wanted. Whether it was 42 proof vodka or gin or any of that stuff, it was right there. And as a hypocrite known as a parent, I don't want that. Here in Pennsylvania, I know when I want my whatever it is, I know where to go. You can make informed, intelligent choices. You can plan for it. I don't want it to be an impulse item. And it seems that we're running our programs on vices, on alcohol, on tobacco, on gambling, instead of saying, you know what? It should be part of our budget. TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, get the podcast. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide that flowed beneath the Buddha's sway. Imperial.